This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
What's that sound, Place to Be Nation? It's whatever song we decided to go with for our intro this week. And also the dulcet tones of me, Greg Phillips, as I introduce you to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. We're making this something of a regular occurrence here. This is, what, our 15th podcast, I believe? With me.
Something like that. Yeah.
And so. With me, as always, that voice that you hear coming to you live. Live, of course. As you know, all of our podcasts are live from our studios in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Nick Duke! Nicholas, hello on this pleasant evening.
Yeah, I mean, they are certainly live on this fine Thursday or Friday or Saturday or Sunday or whatever day you happen to be listening to it. It is, of course, a live broadcast. And on this fine day, whatever day it may be, a better question to ask than what's that sound is, as always, what's that smell?
Dookie!
Indeed.
Yes, we are bringing to you a very special edition of the wildly popular Off the Page. This is, of course, where we examine some piece of comic book media that is not a comic book. Thus far, we've limited it exclusively to television and films, but that will be changing in the near future. Because this occasion, though, we had to bring in somebody special. We had to bring in another guest, because we're looking at the ultimate edition of Batman v. Superman Dawn of Justice. Recently released on Blu-ray and DVD. And so joining us to discuss this is the man who reviewed the theatrical cut for Place to Be Nation, the illustrious, the well-traveled author of Sellers Points, as well as the voice of Sellers Points, Mr. Russell Sellers. He'll be joining us in the second half of the show to discuss this controversial and divisive movie and this other version of that movie that we'll get into a little bit later on. But before we get to all that, I mean, that's going to be pretty cool, so stay tuned for that. Before we get to all that, we're going to hit you up with our usual opening salvo, as it were. And we're going to kick things off, I think, this week with what you're reading and what you're watching. And we're going to start with watching, because this past week saw the finale of the long-awaited, much-anticipated AMC series Preacher, based on the classic Garth Ennis, Steve Dillon series. Now, Nick and I did not address Preacher last week on our podcast because I hadn't yet watched it. Over the weekend, I watched last week's episode and then watched this week's episode, the finale. So now we are fully ready to talk about the season that was Preacher. Now, Nick, you and I are both huge fans of this book, huge fans of the comic book series. What did you think, first of all, of the finale, and second of all,
the finale and the season as a whole are very much the same in that I generally think, on the whole,
Preparation H
does feel good on the whole. On the whole, I feel like the season was well directed, well acted, well shot. I mean, and for the most part, well written. For the most part, with, you know, our tulip hiccups here and there, as we've mentioned before. And I feel the same way about the finale. But I couldn't help, after the finale, feeling a sense of pointlessness. As in, do we really need to spend 10 episodes to get to the point in the story that we all wanted to get to? To get to the point in the story where the comic picks up. And I've come to realize, and maybe, and I'm sure that Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon would have done a more interesting take on Jesse and Anvil, but perhaps the reason Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon didn't address that time period very much is because that time period wasn't very interesting. There were cool character moments sprinkled throughout this season, but in terms of the overall plot of what was going down in Anvil, I gotta say, I'm much more excited about seeing where they take it out on the road on season two rather than confining it to one location, because Preacher essentially was always, in the comic anyway, a road trip story.
Yep.
You know, bouncing around from different locale to locale, our three heroes, our three main characters, palling around in a car or a beat up old truck, arguing over what music to listen to. So, I mean, I think the road trip aspect of it will help the show a great deal. Again, not that the season was bad. I mean, we've shouted out numerous moments as, you know, being worthy of high praise. I think the finale had some of those moments as well. But, you know, in general, I think this is just a solid foundation to build upon and hopefully reach the heights the show deserves to reach.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing that I want to do is come off like Grandpa Simpson yelling at a cloud. You know, I don't want to be the comic book fan that hates the Walking Dead show because it's not like the book or whatever, or because it does something different from the book. But that being said, I'm kind of going to be that on this case, because I feel like if you liked this season of Preacher, which a lot of people did, you would love the book, because the book does, in my opinion, everything better. But I'd agree with that. That being said, there were a lot of good. I'm not completely, even in the season finale, there were a lot of good things. But what I mentioned to you, Nick, off the air earlier today, is after I watched it
on whatever day this
right,
may be,
exactly on month or a day, I
in the wonderful month of June.
That's right. I mentioned to you that the only, I couldn't even say if I liked the finale or disliked the finale, or somewhere in the middle even, I just left with a weird feeling. I can't even really just put my finger on it, but I just felt weird. And I think you hit the nail on part of that in the fact that what was the point of all of this?
I mean, they killed off, or we are led to believe anyway, they killed off every character, literally, except for our three leads, the one of the angels and the Saint of Killers. Who does not appear to really be the Saint of Killers, by the way.
Right. Although I think he is, I just think they haven't explained how that is the case.
Okay.
Because I think that he did kill that angel at the end. But I don't think that they have explained yet. They haven't explained yet how he got out of hell, much less how he was able to develop this power. I assume that will be shown in the next season. I am much more excited for season two, because now they've established that road trip story. They have finally given some backstory to Tulip, even though I still think there are issues there. I think they did a good
I guess we need to address that one then there.
Of giving her a little bit of history at least.
Right. I feel like we should take a moment and pause there and kind of talk about that particular plot development. So we're going to get into a little bit of spoiler territory here, but, you know, Greg, you and I have complained all season long that Tulip is unlikable.
Yes.
She's essentially a bitch, a cold-hearted bitch at that.
Yep.
And in this episode, in the finale, they attempted to give you a reason for her world outlook and the way she has been treating people. I can understand why it might not work for some people. And I'm not going to say it was a slam dunk for me, but I'm going to say it was just enough to make me reconsider that character. And I mean just the bare minimum enough to make me reconsider that character. I am willing to give her a fresh look in season two and see if they can work to continue to redeem her. The reason they gave being that she essentially is driven by a mission of revenge, not because of Carlos costing, you know, her relationship with Jesse, but because Carlos cost her unborn child, essentially.
Yes, which I, you know, again, I have no issue with that backstory. You know, I guess you could make an argument that they essentially fridged a baby in order to provide motivation, but I personally really don't have an issue with I think people overuse the term fridging. I'll put it like that. But
and yet you just
– No, I do because I've – that's the context that people use it in, is a character whose right. death is only used to motivate others, which I would argue extends back into the beginning of fiction. But that's another debate to have another time. I had no issue with that. I actually like that. I like the fact that they gave her something, because to this point I've been given no reason to understand why she's the way that she is and why she treats everyone like crap. So I get it. It wasn't enough for me to completely redeem some of her actions in the season, but there were issues at times with characterizations throughout this season with some of the people even in Anvil, including Jim the Anvil, Nightheart, who was completely out of character in this show.
Speaking of characterizations that seemed a bit off, you know, we're mostly talking about the finale, but like you said, we did not mention last week's episode either, so I think we should pause here because I want to call out one of the biggest what-the-fuck character moments of the entire season, and that being Emily, who we had been led to believe was the one good and decent person on the entire show, choosing to feed her sometimes somewhat boyfriend to Cassidy for no real reason at all.
It was clear that she didn't like the guy, but it wasn't clear that she hated him, and it wasn't clear why she thought it was okay to sacrifice somebody who pretty much cared for her kids while she was doing errands for Jesse just to save Cassidy, who she didn't even like that much. So, very bizarre. I agree. Completely out of character. Right. That was a bad moment. But I mean, and that's the thing. Like, again, I felt so weird because there were so many high points this season. Cassidy, of course, being the highest point. I think we would all agree on that. That watched the show. Cassidy, it was
he steals
it. It's his show right now. It's his show. But close second being Odin Kincannon, as played by Jackie Earle Haley, phenomenal.
And let's hope he found a way to survive the tragic methane cow shit explosion.
Right, the you know, the manure explosion as he cradled his meat daughter. That was great. There were a lot of great character, rather great comedy moments. I think the finale actually took me a step back on Jesse, though, because I don't know if it's just me. Maybe I'm the outlier here, but I feel like Jesse's been all over the place this season from a character standpoint.
Absolutely has been all over the place. I'll agree with you on that. And I'm gonna chalk that up to just, you know, the writers having to find that character, because I feel like the last two episodes they started to dial him back from where he was, which was in a very unlikable place, in my opinion.
Agreed. I think that that's another part that's hard for people and jarring for people that read the comics, because in the comics, the one thing Jesse is to a fault is stubborn and beholden to his beliefs, beholden to his moral code and his idea of right and wrong. Now, that changes over the course of the story, but whatever he believes to be right, he's going to do it, and he's going to stick by it. And this has been a more wishy-washy Jesse, a Jesse who at one moment feels one way, and then the next, you know, sometimes within the same scene, feels completely different.
Could the argument perhaps be made that version of Jesse to which we are so attached from the comics doesn't really make an emergence in the comics until after he's dealt with a certain factor in his life that was constantly hanging over his head? And might that not be the case for this version of Jesse as well?
Maybe. I still thought he was – because even in the flashbacks of the Preacher book, when you see he and Tulip on the run, he still had that stubborn – whatever I think is right at this time, I'm going to see it through to the end kind of deal. But, you know, that was just my take. But overall, I don't want to knock the show because I still enjoyed the hell out of it. I mean, the finale made me laugh out loud numerous times. Gave some really good acting moments from Jackie Earle Haley as Odin Kincannon. And a guy I wanted to shout out to, the guy that plays Hugo Root. We were hard on him earlier in the season because he's not at all like the comic book version. It turned into a pretty damn good character, I thought.
Turned into a pretty compelling character. Yeah, like you said, not at all Hugo Root as we knew him, but I don't think there's room on television for a guy like Hugo Root as we know him.
Not with the existence of Twitter, certainly.
Not with the existence of Twitter, and not given the current political climate we exist right. in. So, probably for the best. But, you know, all that being said, I think you and I are of the same mind that, you know, not a bad season, not a great season. I'd say it's the Mike Sanders of television.
Yeah, above average. Yep, solid
above average.
Solid 3.0.
Solid 3.0. Solid B+. And here we go, heading into season two, and hopefully they will rectify the issues. They'll find the character voices, and they will hopefully pick a great subplot from the comics on which to base their season, rather than attempting to come up with their own original story again. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. Enough with all the preambulizing. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yes, and the next thing, of course, is our What You Reading segment. And as you know, we've got a new format here, and we're going to stick with that format this week. And we're going to go ahead and start out with our number 3 book of the week. Now, I will preface this in that I have not read that many books this week. I went out of town this past weekend, actually, to visit Russell. We were going to a mutual friend's party, and I have not had much time to read.
Party.
Well, okay, call it a baby shower. Right. And it was a party, though. It was a party of adults who most of whom already had children, except for us and our friend Garner. But that's fine. Anyhow, so I haven't had time to read many comics, but I've read enough to do this segment. So let's get cracking with our number 3 book of the week. Nick, you start us out.
As our listeners will discover throughout this show, there has not been a podcast we've done yet that Greg has been more prepared for. He is on top of all the requirements, the prerequisites for this show
this
week. So with that being said, I'm going to give you my number 3 book of the week, and that will be a number 3 issue for Wonder Woman. As I told you offline, Greg, it only took about, let's see, the Rebirth issue, the number 1, and the number 3. So it only took 3 issues, but Liam Sharp has quickly become one of my favorite artists in comics. The way he draws Diana, the way he draws the cheetah is just it's a tour de force in this issue. Greg Rucka continues to provide a story that is certainly taking its time. I can understand why some might find it too slow-paced, but me, I love it. It feels like they're building a lot of tension, and they're building to something that's going to be important. I don't want to get too deep into spoilers and kind of the bargain that the cheetah strikes with Diana here, but just because you haven't read it, but looking forward to your thoughts whenever you do get a chance to read it. Wonder Woman, I think, continues to be probably my third or fourth favorite book of Rebirth thus far. So I'm going to go with Wonder Woman number 3 as my number 3.
Outstanding. As for me, for my number 3, again, my selection, my readings were pretty limited thus far. I've got a big stack that I haven't read yet, but for my number 3 book of the week, I am going to go with Nightwing number 1. This is a book that I honestly have kind of mixed feelings about. Let me start off with the good, because I think Tim Seeley has a very good handle on who Dick Grayson is. He's written him for a long time now, but who Dick Grayson as Nightwing in particular is. The internal monologue really worked for me in this book. The dialogue worked for me. Dick is written as the smart, sarcastic, funny, driven character that I know him to be. So I enjoy that aspect of it. I think the relationships are really well done in this book. His relationship with Bruce, his relationship with Damian, and his relationship with Barbara Gordon are very well portrayed here. In fact, and this is a hint for something to come later, Barbara Gordon is written better in this Nightwing issue than she was in her own. So that's all wonderful. It's great to see Dick back in costume again. It's great to see him out on his own doing his thing. It's great to see a scene between Bruce and he where Bruce kind of gives him his blessing to do whatever he feels is right. All that stuff is great. The characterizations, terrific. The dialogue, very good. My problem, if I have a problem, and I do have something of a problem with this, the overall story direction worries me. And it worries me for a few reasons. First of all, the end of this issue, as you warned me about, features a scene in which Dick Grayson gets the absolute living crap beaten out of him and told that everything he's learned from Batman is weak and useless and not relevant. Which, if I had a nickel for every time I've seen Dick Grayson get his ass kicked in his own comic, I would be a millionaire at this point. Or at least a thousand.
You would have a lot of
nickels. I would have at least several nickels, because it happens quite frequently.
It's the Ric Flair turning on Sting of Nightwing comics. Like, every time you turn around, it's happening.
Nightwing is portrayed as somebody who isn't really that good at fighting a lot of the time. He's okay when he's beating up thugs, but not when he's fighting someone that's actually good, which is not really what the development of Dick would have you believe. But that part worries me. I like Raptor. I have no problem with Raptor as a character. It's kind of a new take on an old Nightwing villain. But I'm not really sure about this, about, you know, he, as Barbara even mentions in the story, we just got out of a year-long story in which he was undercover infiltrating an organization as a double agent. Now we're doing another story where he's infiltrating an organization as a double agent. Also, the whole, it negated the entire idea of Bruce telling Dick that he's learned all there is to learn, he's on his own anymore now. Because now you're basically doing a storyline where it's obvious that Dick is going to pick up pointers from Raptor as he goes along about new ways to do things. Ultimately, he'll reject the moral standpoint of Raptor, obviously. But I don't have a lot of faith in DC Comics to treat Nightwing well. And this book is not doing a lot to assuage my worries about that from a plot standpoint. Again, characterization good, though. So I know I talked too long about that, but that's my number three.
I'll just say that I agree with all of your criticisms. For me, I thought the interior monologue was spotty. I thought it had high points and it had low points. I'll agree with you on the relationships. However, as we've discussed, the bar to make my pull list is so high at this point that I've made the decision I'm dropping Nightwing going forward. I'll probably pick up the Night of the Monster Men crossover tie-in issues off the shelf, but in terms of being a regular pull for me, I can't continue to pull it when there are so many other things out here that I'm enjoying so much. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. Moving on to my number two, and this is a book that makes, every time an issue comes out, it makes an appearance, and I'm going to go with Old Man Logan number 9. Go ahead, Greg.
No, you go ahead.
No. I figured you had something to say.
No, I don't have anything to say.
I'm stunned you're not doing your number 9 from the beginning.
No, I'm going to leave that. I was going to leave that to be, you know, but now that you mentioned it, number 9.
In any event, Old Man Logan number 9. Absolutely love this book, and I, you know, again, this is another book you haven't read that I want you to read, so I don't want to spoil too much for you, but I will call out specifically, we have talked before about how my favorite artist in comics going right now is Andrea Sorrentino, and, you know, one of the reasons I love him so much is because I think he has some of the most innovative layouts of any artist in comics, and I'm going to call out one splash page. That's right, I'm going to take all my time out of this book talking about one splash page. There is a splash page in this book where Old Man Logan jumps through this window, this plate glass window, and the central image of the splash page is him jumping through the window, and there are shards flying off in all directions. And in each shard, you get a different image of him interacting with one of the thugs in the bar. So you have a giant, awesome Andrea Sorrentino Old Man Logan jumping through the window with a bunch of drawings of him taking out people in brutal, brutal fashion surrounding it. It's one of the coolest splash pages I've ever seen. It is absolutely
It should
phenomenal.
Be noted that those are shards, not sharts. So.
Yes, shards. Yes, that's what I said. In any event, this is a fantastic title. I'm glad it's continuing and not being canceled as we originally feared. And I cannot wait for you to read it one day. I think you will be blown away.
Oh, absolutely. As I was perusing the comic book store in Montgomery, Alabama the other day, I came across the cover to this issue. And I remarked to our mutual friend, Mr. Andrew Chandler Fraser Garner, the 17th, that the cover to this issue was the best cover on the stand, easily, because it's simple, but man, is it to the point. And no cover made me want to buy the book more than that one. That was just an outstanding cover. So, certainly one day I truly will read this series, and I'm sure I'll love it as much as you have, because you know how much I love the old Knucklehead.
And I'm going to say this. It's not quite there yet, but this is starting to approach the Lemire Sorrentino Green Arrow for me in terms of quality.
Very high praise. We're both high on that. Well, let me move on then to my number two book of the week, and that would be Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number one. Now, again, I'm kind of damning it with faint praise because of the lack of competition, because I haven't read all these other issues that I need to read. But I will say this, very, very good start to this series, because already this is Hal Jordan. This is not the imposter Hal Jordan that we've had for, in my opinion, for 3 years now. Continues to write Hal, but Robert Venditti, the writer, continues to write Hal as brave, as courageous, as fearless, as not an idiot as he was often written in the last 3 years. Or a hobo, most importantly, or as Gambit. So very good, very effective, and he's good. I thought the characterization of Sinestro in this issue was really good. All the Sinestro Corps stuff was very well done. The one thing in particular that I like is they've given themselves an out with Sinestro returning to pure villainy, as opposed to the conflicted, almost anti-hero approach that we've had since the New 52 started, in that Sinestro absorbs the Parallax entity in this issue. And in my hope is that one day we will reveal that the Parallax entity is at least exerting some influence over Sinestro's actions. So I think that's going to help explain the return to traditional villainy for Sinestro.
Absolutely. I also read this book this week and didn't enjoy it as much as you did, probably. I think, and it's unfair, it's an unfair comparison, but to me, whenever Ethan Van Sciver cycles off this book on art, it's a massive drop-off. Not that the art is bad, but just that it is jarring whenever you make that transition from Van Sciver to Sandoval, and I'm going to call him Pablo Sandoval just because.
Well, I feel like Ethan Van Sciver should be tied up and forced to draw Green Lantern constantly, just perpetually.
Well, you know, it would be interesting if there were a concept where, hypothetically anyway, you or I or one of our Place to Be Nation comics staff members might be able to hypothetically force Ethan Van Sciver to do just that.
Are you suggesting
more on that in the coming
weeks?
Are
you suggesting it might be getting a little breezy in here, a little drafty, perhaps?
Indeed. A little drafty. You're right. So, moving on, and stop me if you've heard this before, Greg, but my number one book of the week is a book you haven't read. So I'm gonna
Aquaman.
Aquaman didn't
That's
come
right.
out this week, actually, so no. My number one book of the week is Detective Comics 937. This series continues to be, honestly, a better Batman series than the main Batman title. Not that the main Batman title has been bad by any stretch, but this issue, after spending, I think, the last three issues really focusing in on the team-building aspect of it and getting you introduced to Spoiler and Tim Drake and Batwoman and Clayface and their, you know, motivation for agreeing to serve on this team, this issue is a reminder of just what a badass Bruce Wayne is. And it works on every level in that regard. It kind of reveals the true nature behind the colony and what their motivations are and why they came to exist. Just a fantastic issue. The art is outstanding. And the first, I'd say, page and a half to 2 pages is an incredibly simple scene. It's a scene that's been done before, and yet it is incredibly effective in getting over just how cool a concept Batman is. So, can't wait for you to read this one as well. And with that being said, I'll bounce it over to you for your number one.
I'm about to break the internet, Nick.
Oh my god!
I'm gonna
do it.
I have to do it. I don't. What do you think? I want to do this. Do you think this makes me feel good? I feel like I'm betraying everything that we're supposed to represent, Nick. I feel like I'm betraying my own kind, my own persona, my own feelings, my own brain, my own heart, my own soul, Nick. Because my number one comic of the week is Red Hood and the Outlaws Rebirth number one by Scott Lobdell and some artist named Soy.
You've been Lobdelled.
I've been Lobdelled for the first time since I was 10 years old. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I know this is not the highest praise that I could give a book, but damn it, this is the first good Scott Lobdell comic book I've read since I was about 10 years old. And he was writing Generation X and all the other X-Men titles. This is also the best Jason Todd story since Under the Hood by Judd Winnick when he first came back. To my unending surprise, Scott Lobdell held back on all of his normal tendencies, his desire to over-explain everything, to kill the reader with dialogue, to write horrendous teenager cliches into all of his characters. Instead, what we get is a retelling of Jason Todd's origin and a setting up of his new status quo that in one issue made Jason Todd more compelling than he's ever been since coming back from the dead. I can't say enough about that. The art was excellent. Dexter Soy, I believe, is the artist's name. The art was excellent. I can't say enough about the characterization of Batman and Jason's relationship, because I don't think the comics have ever done as good a job as the animated film did of really establishing their relationship with each other. And that's honestly the best comparison I can make to it. There are parts of this book that felt like the Under the Red Hood animated film that I can't praise enough. You know, I think it's easily, if not the best, then one of the three or four best animated offerings DC's ever put out. And this is in the tone of that, and especially a scene at the very end, the last page, really was emotionally touching in a way that I didn't expect for a character in Jason Todd that I've come to not really care about over the years. So, really well done. I have zero faith that it's going to continue, because this was all about Jason and they haven't yet introduced the Outlaws yet. And the Outlaws are my biggest concern for this book, because the emotional core of this book and even the story they set up doesn't really seem to have a lot of room for Bizarro or even Artemis to come into. But we'll see how it plays out, and I am tentatively going to give it another issue.
And that's why I say you've been Lobdelled. You know that this book has nothing to do with what the ongoing series is going to be. And you're going to go to your comic shop, you're going to plunk down your $3, and you're going to say, one, please. And then you're going to get home and you're going to read it, and you're going to instantly regret your decision.
And then when that day comes, Nick, I will come right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast, and I'll select it as my worst book of the week, and I'll rant about it.
Greg, when it comes to Scott Lobdell, you can either be part of the solution or part of the problem.
And you've chosen to be part of the problem. Right. I've heard that song and dance before. And I know I've fallen victim to him before as well. I read his interviews when he took over Superman a few years ago, and I was all excited. I was like, oh, he gets it. He's going to focus on Clark and not Kal-El. And then within a few issues, Clark no longer worked at the Daily Planet, and Lois was nowhere to be found. So, you know, good for Scott Lobdell, I suppose. But anyhow, speaking of worst book of the week, let's get to ours, because I think we have the same one as ours.
I believe we do as well. And it sucks, you know, for me to have to sit here and do this, because last week I praised Batgirl and the Birds of Prey Rebirth as the most shockingly good title.
And because of that, I went out and bought it. I just haven't read it yet.
Sadly, its sister title, you could say, Batgirl, not up to that standard, to say the least.
No, completely agreed. Batgirl number one is
the first outright bad comic of the
week. Yes, I would agree with that. It is not good. I mentioned earlier that Batgirl's portrayal in Nightwing was very good. Not even it doesn't even appear to be the same character in this book.
Right. It, to borrow another old phrase of mine, it's a boring comic about boring versions of these characters.
I was going to say, Nick, this is not the worst comic I've read or anything like that. It's not an all-time bad comic, but here's what I was going to say about it. It is probably on a short list of the most boring comics I've ever read.
Wholly uninteresting
just
in every way.
Nothing interesting happens. And no. I hate to belabor the point too much, but it introduces one of the stupidest named characters I've ever seen in my life.
You mean you didn't love the 95-year-old Fruit Bat,
ladies and gentlemen. The legendary Fruit Bat, which, and I'm not going to say this very often, is a sub-Morrison name. It's a name that Grant Morrison would write down in his sketchbook and say, no, nope, that's just too over the top, too silly, and cross it out in favor of Le Bossu. It's just not a good comic book. I mean, the art is not good.
The art isn't even good. Like, nothing about
Raphael
it.
Raphael Albuquerque did the art, and he's very highly acclaimed, but it's not good art. The character faces look weird. The designs are weird. It looks almost sketchy in nature.
And then you have this new side character, Kai, I believe his name is, who pretty much is like generic male figure 101. Like, there is nothing interesting or different or distinctive about this dude in any way. Like, why would you care about this person? Why would you choose to write this guy as a featured character in a comic book? Like, there's just nothing here, man.
The climax of the book is about a 2-page fight scene in which no punches are actually landed. It's just and another climax is they eat octopus and Kai throws up in the bathroom.
Yeah, it's awful, man. Like, you know, as someone who did not enjoy the Batgirl of Burnside time period, you know, that just wasn't for me. I was somebody who really wanted a good Batgirl comic, one that I could enjoy and sink my teeth into. And it's clear that this is not that, but that Batgirl and the Birds of Prey very much could be that.
It's also another thing that I don't like, and it's interesting I use the word like. I, like, don't like that they write Batgirl to, like, talk like this, like, all the time. Like, that's not, like, how I've ever, like, heard, like, Barbara talking, if that makes sense.
This is, and I'm sure some of our listeners will disagree. I'm sure Russell would disagree with this. That is a relic of the Batgirl of Burnside days. And that was, I will say it was not overused to the degree it was in this issue, but it was added to the character in a way that Gail Simone never would have used it. And yes, I'm holding up Gail Simone as the standard bearer for Barbara Gordon writers, as she should
be. I counted 8 uses of like in a sentence that was not the proper usage of like. The way that we would use it in like a casual conversation, maybe once or twice or 3 times even. Batgirl's supposed to be a genius. She's supposed to be one of the smartest characters in the DC universe, and they have her talking like we did in 10th grade, you know what I mean? Like, it's just very strange. I don't like that. And the other thing, this doesn't bother me as much as it bothers some, the return of the thought bubbles. The usage of it here bothered me. The thought bubbles on the very last page I'm going to turn to, and I'm actually going to recite it because I feel like it's so overly expository. It's no coincidence we're both here. You're hiding something, a secret formula or an ugly past. I'm going to keep you close till I find out what. I mean, that's really clunky.
It's written like the worst, like a bad example of a Silver Age comic, essentially.
Yes, I would agree with that. But we've belabored the point,
We have. I don't think you have any quick hits.
I have one quick hit, which is a leftover of – I'm not talking about the crappy Green Lantern villain relic. I'm talking about a leftover of 2 weeks ago, and that is the Heckblazer Rebirth number 1, in which we are reintroduced to John Constantine. I read it. Perfectly average comic. That's all I have to say about it.
You're not even going to actually refer to it by its real name?
I don't know what you mean by its real name.
Hellblazer, Greg. It's called
Hellblazer. Oh, no, that's not the book that I bought.
Well, that would explain why your book was exceedingly average. I'll hit you with a few quick hits of mine. I got Action Comics 960, and I will praise this book for one line and one line alone. In one line, Wonder Woman strikes the Clark Diana romance of the New 52 down to the depths it should have been stricken to begin with. I'll say Civil War II number 4 ends on a promise that in the next issue there's actually going to be a civil war. 6 issues later, it appears there's actually going to be heroes fighting. The Mighty Thor number 9 continues to be, you know, Mighty Thor is just the picture of consistency. I will say, since this Russell Dodderman run with Jason Aaron as the artist, you know, it hasn't been to the heights of Thor God of Thunder, but it's still been a good book every time it hits the stands, with the exception of those god-awful Rafa Garris drawn issues. And then, of course, Titans number 1, enjoyed it very much. I feel like I'm missing a little bit due to my lack of knowledge about Wally West and his previous villains, but I will say it's a great, great comic, with the exception of, and maybe this is just the version of Roy Harper they're writing, but this is a douchey, douchey Roy Harper.
Yes, a character who has been written as a douche for about, the better part of the last 20 years, though, in fairness.
That's what I'm saying. I was leaving that that
camera. All right, so that wraps up our reading watching. Let's get on to our very brief rundown this week. We've got 3 items to discuss with you, news and notes from the comic book world. The first involving the Marvel Cinematic Universe, namely the Avengers franchise. Nicholas?
Yeah, so, you know, the rumor had been, or the release slate that the MCU had set out for Phase 3 had always shown that in 2018 and 2019, in consecutive Mays, we were going to get back-to-back Avengers movies without having to wait the standard, you know, 2 or 3 years. And the rumor was this was going to be a 2-part Infinity War movie. They were going to split that movie into 2 parts. Well, you know, the word came down a few months back that they were not going to be necessarily calling it Infinity War Part 1 and Part 2. Well, news came down this week that took it a step further. Apparently, Avengers 3, which comes out in May of 2018, has been officially titled as Avengers Infinity War. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Some have taken that
term.
Some might say that that means that Avengers 4 is no longer directly linked to Avengers 3 and that it's not a direct continuation of the same story. Which means some are taking this to mean that Infinity War is now going to be crammed into one movie. I don't think there's been any definitive word on that, but that appears to be a possibility that's on the table.
If that
right
were
now.
The case, it would be a mistake, in my opinion.
I agree.
Because what has been the what has been the uniting thread of the most critically maligned comic book movies that they tried to fit too much into them? Whether it be Green Lantern, whether it be Batman, Superman, whether it be even Age of Ultron, which we like, the complaints have been that they tried to fit too much story into them. Going all the way back to X-Men 3. And I think that with something on this kind of a scale, you need to let it breathe, and you need to do something to make Thanos stand out. And what better way than what I have imagined is going to happen this whole time, which is you go Empire Strikes Back on this, and you end Infinity War with Thanos getting the Infinity Gauntlet. I'm assuming – I am basing this assumption off of Infinity War will focus largely on Thanos attempting to gain control of all of the gems. And when he does, he gets the Infinity Gauntlet, and boom, he wins. And we end it on a down note where the heroes are down, seemingly out, no hope. And then you come back in the next one, and they make the big comeback. Basically, you get heat on Thanos, you set up the big rematch, babyface goes over.
You work a body part and you
lay
your shit in,
kid. For God's sake. Pour one out for the working man.
Indeed. No, I agree with you completely. I don't necessarily buy the idea that these two movies are no longer linked, no matter how much the Russo brothers are trying to convince us of that. I am still standing by this is essentially a two-part story, even if there is a cleaner break between the two than we had originally been led to believe. So let's wait and see on this, but I'm betting Infinity War, even if it doesn't share that title, that actual storyline will very much carry over into Avengers 4. Is that what you're thinking as well?
Yes, I think so.
All right, cool. Moving on to the DC side of things, we got our first look this week at the first instance of one of the quote-unquote big three coming to the CW, and that, of course, being Tyler Hoechlin? Hoechlin?
Hoechlin?
Tyler H's Superman, as, you know, shown in this publicity still that they released. And man, what a terrible publicity still.
Yes. In several ways, but primarily to do with the actual look of him as Superman. I know a lot of people were dismissive of the suit, making fun of it. I liked the costume. I thought the costume was different enough, but looked good. I especially liked the fact that the costume had a belt, which many modern Superman costumes don't really have.
I thought the costume looked fine. I thought it looked visually similar enough to the Supergirl costume to have a visual continuity there. So I was fine with the costume.
Yeah, but the actual look of him, he looked like – he basically kind of looked like Superman in the first half of Superman 3 when he's drinking at the bar.
I was about to say drunk Superman. That's
drunk
what
Superman.
Like.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was saying, hey, Kira, how you doing?
which is his cousin, so it's drunk redneck Superman.
Apparently. Hey, that's a movie we need to get one day.
Absolutely. It can't be any creepier than him watching Lois from above her house in Superman Returns.
And presumably, well, I'm not gonna go into what he was presumably doing at that time. But
well, what was he presumably doing, Greg?
Well, clearly just taking notes about Lois's life.
Indeed. But the saving grace of this is a couple days later, some set leaks came out that showed him actually walking around in the daytime and not in an overexposed, over-photoshopped publicity still.
Mm-hmm.
And the suit looks a lot better. A lot better.
And it looks a lot brighter, too, than it did in the publicity shot.
Which that seems to be a move from DC Public Relations 101. Just grab a photo and remove all the color from it.
Saturate it. Or desaturate it, rather.
It makes no sense why that's their go-to for publicity still.
I don't get it either. But he looked great on the set. Absolutely. He even has the spit curl going, the classic Superman spit curl. So big, big fan of how he looks on set. Looks like he's going to fit in perfectly with the world they've established on Supergirl.
Absolutely.
Now, on our final rundown item is a sad note for many longtime readers, and for some, perhaps, not a sad note. That is the news that J. Michael Straczynski, longtime comic book, television, etc. writer, longtime writer of Amazing Spider-Man, Thor, Superman, Superman Earth 1, a variety of titles, has announced that due to health reasons, partially, and also due to just a general feeling that he's done with it, he is leaving comics permanently. He is going on to write plays and screenplays. So he said that he's leaving it behind. I think that he has indicated he may finish up one last project for DC, which presumably would be Superman Earth 1. And if that is the case, that'd be great. But if not, I understand. Nick, what was your reaction to this news?
It wasn't that surprising, given the fact that he had kind of scaled back a lot of his big two work already anyway, and wasn't really that prolific at independent work anymore either. I did not know about the eye disorder. Essentially, he has some sort of eye disorder that had been affecting his vision greatly, going back almost 10 years. The good news is he says he's had some corrective surgery that have greatly, greatly alleviated his eyesight issues, but he said that it called to mind the fact that he needs to spend the rest of his life challenging himself, and he's looking to challenge himself in new ways, and that's going to be writing, some scripts and some novels. I would encourage anybody who has an interest in JMS or is a fan of the guy's work. This week he actually penned an open letter to the comics community that was posted on Newsarama. So if you get a chance to go check that out, it's a long read, but it's a good read. And as someone who was a big fan of his Spider-Man, a big fan of his Thor work, I'm going to say he's sorely missed, and I hate that he left Marvel the way he did. I hate that his run has essentially been wiped away by Joe Quesada and his one more day hard on that he has. And one day I hope that he reverses this decision and cranks out one last Spider-Man story, one more time for all time, if you will. But hats off to JMS, and hope he finds happiness in whatever he chooses to do.
Absolutely. As somebody who doesn't have a whole lot of exposure to JMS, I've read a little bit of his Spider-Man, which is very good from what I've read. I've read a little bit of his Thor, which was good. And I've read a little bit of his Superman Earth 1, which was good. Or at least the part that I read was good. It's a shame anytime you see a legendary creator, a creator with a big name, a creator who has done some really great work in the comics medium go away. But that being said, best of luck to him. You know, these creators, they don't owe us anything. They do not owe fans a damn thing. Just like wrestlers don't owe us a damn thing. All they owe us is their output. And if he feels like it's time for him to move on and do something else to make him happy, he's got to do what's best for him. So good for him, and I hope he's successful and happy doing whatever it is he's doing for the rest of his career. So
absolutely. And hey, I'm gonna throw a bonus one at you that you didn't know was coming, and this will be very quick, I promise. But I wanted to throw a shout out and a rest in peace to a guy that you may not have never heard of, Jack Davis. A founding Mad Magazine cartoonist, also one of the old EC comics, you know, the old horror comics, mm-hmm. where Tales from the Crypt got their start. He was an artist for them back in the day, but prominently, and the reason I know him, he was a University of Georgia alumni, and he was responsible pretty much up until about 2 years ago. The man was 95 when he died. So up until he was about 93, he was still drawing weekly original artwork for every single Georgia home game for the last better part of 35 to 40 years, and he passed away this past week. So shout out to Jack Davis and all his work in the comics industry.
A life well lived, certainly. And with that said, we're going to get you into a commercial break, ladies and gentlemen, so we can get right into the heart of the matter, which is our review of Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice Ultimate Edition. And we're going to talk about this movie with our good friend Russell Sellers, and we're going to do so at a medium pace.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds as well. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickerstaff, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with good old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Until you said that, I actually had forgotten. We did our audience a disservice in the first half of the show. So,
oh,
Greg, I don't. There it is. And that sound, of course, is the illustrious Ho Ho Loon Ticker. And we are here to let you know, of course, that Ho Ho Loon is still alive in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, there's still time to put your money down. The smart money's on Ho Ho Loon to go all the way. And we're willing to take your money. If you send it in to us, we'll put it into the bank and we'll ride that straight to the top. Because as you know, wrestling betting has never been hotter than it is right now. And the guy to ride to the top is Ho Ho Loon. So,
absolutely. But we digress.
We digress. And with that update, we would like to welcome in to our luxurious Vancouver studios, a longtime buddy of ours, the host of Sellers Points, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you doing after the long trip from Alabama all the way up here to Vancouver?
I don't know how you two do it. It's freaking cold up here.
It is.
I'm not used to this.
And well, we don't have any kind of travel budget either.
No. Right. It's I'll tell you how you deal with the cold. It's fairly easy. Our control center is actually across the street from the sets for Arrow and the Flash, and so we just look over and see Stephen Amell, and we get this warm, toasty feeling all up and down our body that helps us to perk right up.
Yep. I'm totally on board with this idea.
We even have a salmon ladder set up outside in between the sets, just so he'll be forced to do it on his way walking back and forth.
That's it. Not that either of us are capable of it, but it's a scientific fact that Stephen Amell could not walk past a salmon ladder without performing on said ladder.
That's right. Well, Russell, thanks for joining us for this special edition of Off the Page. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty well, and thank you guys for having me on. This is going to be a good time. I have deliberately not given my thoughts or opinions on this version of Batman v Superman since it released, specifically because I was waiting for an opportunity like this to do just that.
And I'm sure we'll all have thoughts aplenty.
I think that
I'm at a loss for words, really, and that's. But we'll get into it.
That hasn't happened to you in years.
Speechlessness.
Let us start with a little bit of background here. Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice is the second official entry in the DC Extended cinematic universe that began with Man of Steel itself, a highly divisive film. Let's start with that as a baseline, just really quickly, because we don't want to dwell on that too much before we get started on the actual movie. Where do we all stand on Man of Steel? Highly divisive. I'm a fan of it. I think it's really good. It's got some flaws, certainly, but I think it's excellent. I think it's one of the best Superman movies ever made. It was a, for me anyway, it was a modern take on Superman that I was waiting for. I think it stands as one of Snyder's better, Zack Snyder, the director's better movies. Nick?
I'm going to play the role of the internet trolls who have been writing reviews of the new Ghostbusters movie. And let me tell you why and what I mean by that. There have been pieces written about how, with people actually using the thesis, you only hate the new Ghostbusters because you love the old Ghostbusters, and I'm here to break it to you, the old Ghostbusters isn't that good, which is a stupid statement to make. So allow me to make a similar statement. I think Man of Steel is the best Superman movie ever made, and I think it's the best Superman movie ever made because I think the Richard Donner and Christopher Reeve movies aren't that great. That's just my opinion. That version of the character doesn't speak to me in a way I'm sure it does other people, because I've never been overly attached to the character of Superman in a way that you guys have. Man of Steel, to me, did more to humanize the character and make him relatable than practically any Superman-related thing I've ever seen. I stand by that opinion, and I still think Man of Steel is an excellent, excellent film, and one that should have, you know, made for a slam dunk follow-up, at least in my opinion.
Agreed. Russell?
Wow, what can I add to either of that? My opinion of Man of Steel is pretty well documented, but just to reiterate, Greg, I'm right there with you. I do have a bit more of affinity for an affinity for the Christopher Reeve, Richard Donner Superman, of course. Only the first two, three and four.
Right.
Not really Donner films, but still that. However,
and I guess I should add in that I actually like the first Superman movie, the original 78 Superman movie. I think it's pretty good.
Feels like a product of its time, but I'm totally on board with, for me, personally, Nick, I'm right there with you that I consider Man of Steel to be the best Superman movie that's ever been made. And it took cues from lots of my favorite Superman stories over the years, especially my favorite Superman origin stories from Mark Waid's Superman Birthright, some from J. Michael Straczynski's Earth One, and even from the John Byrne Man of Steel era. It's like a little pieces of all of that together to make a fantastic take on Superman, and one that I can watch over and over again. I put it right up there, and this is going to be a little maybe controversial, but I put it right alongside The Dark Knight.
Ooh, now that's treading on sacred ground for Nick, but We'll save that for another time, but I like that. So we all are coming into this as fans of Man of Steel. Now, coming out of Man of Steel, I think all of us expected that we would get a Superman sequel.
Yes.
And instead, Warner Brothers kind of swerved us a little bit by saying that we were going to get Batman versus Superman, which is a project that has been in the works for going on a decade.
Well, actually, Greg, originally it was supposed to be Man of Steel 2 that was going to feature Batman as a side character. That was what was originally sold to us. And then at some point in the development process,
announced.
Right, it became Batman versus Superman, with Batman sharing the title and essentially becoming the co-lead, and eventually, in the theatrical cut, the lead of the movie.
Right, which this is something that's been in the works for over a decade. The writer of Seven, actually, who we've talked about. I feel like we've talked about the writer of Seven on this podcast far more than I ever would have expected, but he actually wrote a draft for a Batman versus Superman movie that predated Batman Begins and was supposed to be that movie, and that project fell through, and we ended up with Batman Begins. And then fast forward a few years later to the Will Smith movie I Am Legend, a WB production, which had a poster for Batman versus Superman in it. So anyway, this project's been bandied about for a long time, and they finally said it was going to happen, very influenced, apparently, from Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns. So What we're going to do now, ladies and gentlemen, as we do with Off the Page, is as we talk about the project itself and the film itself, we're gonna start watching the movie. We're not going to watch the whole thing. We're not going to be here for 4 hours, ladies and gentlemen, or 3 hours. But what we're going to do is we're going to have it on as background to kind of remind us of things, to bring up new points to discuss. And we want you to watch along with us if you so desire. So if you have the Ultimate Edition, which is the 3 hour long cut, make sure you have that version in. And we are about to hit play. And when we count you down, hit play with us, and you'll be able to follow us along a little bit better, perhaps. So I'll just count us down, starting at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play. And so as we get into this project, this Batman v Superman project, let's start out by saying, what were your thoughts in advance of it? Russell, I'm going to start with you this time. What were your thoughts when the project was announced, and what kind of story were you expecting, if anything, or did you go in with any expectations at all?
When it was announced, you mean when it was officially titled Batman v Superman?
Right.
From that point, I was not crazy about the name initially, mostly because I just not digging on, you know, versus movies. That just doesn't necessarily appeal to me. But that they subtitled it Dawn of Justice, that brought to mind, okay, well, we're definitely headed into Justice League. It was a lot like when Marvel did Captain America, the First Avenger. You knew what was coming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, yeah, that's what I expected. I expected it to be two heroes who misunderstand each other, come into conflict, likely over some stuff that happened at the end of Man of Steel, you know, and fair enough. They battle it out a little bit, and then they come together to take on a larger threat at the end of the movie, to which, you know, at the time had no idea what that threat might be, but I can't say that Doomsday didn't cross my mind.
Right. Nick, what about you? Actually, before I get to that, we're currently watching some point or another, a retelling of Batman's origin. We actually talked in, I can't remember if it was a podcast or a column, and before this movie came out, and you said the one thing you didn't want to see is the pearls. Now, did that bother you at all in this case?
It doesn't. It never necessarily bothers me. I just feel like it's been done to death, man. Like, and I get that it's an important iconic image, and I get why it's always included. It's just, to me, I don't think there's a new angle to bring it to it. You know, I don't think there's a new artistic way to shoot it that's gonna do it any better than Chris Nolan did it. And that's just my, you know, opinion on a lot of things Batman. So, I mean, I don't begrudge them for doing it. I actually do like this edition. If you're watching the Ultimate Cut, they extend this a little bit, and you get a little bit more of that Frank Miller image of the gun being inside the pearl string.
Yes,
and that
I'm looking
whole
at that right now.
So that actually is something a little bit new and different that, to my knowledge anyway, a filmed adaptation hasn't done before. So I think my criticism of the pearl thing was overblown a bit, honestly. But it's a fine retelling of the origin, in my opinion, even though I think the kid who plays Bruce looks like a douche. But that's just me.
Has there ever been a kid to play young Bruce that hasn't looked like a douche, though, in fairness?
I thought the Batman Begins kid didn't look like a douche, but that's just me.
A little bit, but I will say this: it is pretty cool to see these two. These are instantly my favorite Thomas and Martha Waynes, just because of the actors playing them. Granted, yep, we got more Thomas Wayne in Batman Begins, but this, you know, this is Jeffrey Dean Morgan, yes, and Lauren Cohen, who plays Maggie on The Walking Dead. So,
and not to get too far off topic, but won't it be kind of cool if certain reveals are made in the season premiere of Walking Dead to look back on this later?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's just so interesting that they're both on that show now. So anyway, really cool. But I want to get to you, Nick.
Hey, sorry. I want to shout out something that, you know, and I want to give credit to DC Comics. This popped up during the opening credits just now. DC, after years of resisting, is finally giving credit to not just Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster for creating Superman, but I believe Batman vs. Superman is also the first film to give credit to Bill Finger for,
yep,
helping to create Batman and not giving Bob Kane all the credit as he had demanded contractually and as his estate had demanded in the year since his death. So shout out to DC for, after decades of getting it so blatantly wrong, finally getting it right for once on credit where credit is due for both these characters.
Absolutely.
So what was your question?
My question was, what were your
thoughts? No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Going into this movie, into this project, what were your thoughts when it was announced, and what were you expecting going in?
You know, kind of like Russell said, I mean, you feel like these versus stories, while they haven't really been done on the big screen very much, have kind of been done to death in the comics, and they're kind of along the same lines. You know, heroes have a misunderstanding, then they fight, and Joe's doll looks like Joe, and eventually they come back together in the end against a common enemy. I wasn't necessarily thinking Doomsday, because to me, I thought Doomsday meant you have to kill off Superman if you do Doomsday, and that
way was too soon, right?
That's way too soon, right?
Yeah,
it would have been, and it was.
but so let's get into the theatrical.
Let's all take a moment to enjoy this Jeep commercial right here.
Yeah, like, you know, very perfunctory.
Possibly,
I guess.
The least amount of money Jeep has spent producing a commercial ever.
That's true, actually. It makes me wish that we could see Matthew McConaughey driving around somewhere in this, because he does the best car commercials. But
this is also, especially this Ultimate Edition, as you'll see throughout the movie, is one of the biggest advertisements for CNN and headline news I've ever seen in my life, because I think every single CNN anchor has a cameo in this movie doing a taped bit.
This is Soledad O'Brien.
This is Soledad O'Brien. This is Nancy Grace.
It's Wolf
this
Blitzer.
Wolf Blitzer. I mean, like, they're all in the movie doing various talking head bits at different junctures.
Wolf Blitzer's hair.
Wolf Blitzer's hair. Yeah, where's Ollie Williams when you need him? That's what I want to know.
Here's a conveniently placed bottle of Diet Dr. Pepper.
And see, but I have to be honest, like, I don't really mind product placement in movies. It's never bothered me, because I've always liked that better than, like, the when they grab a Coke and it just says generic cola.
Cola.
Soda cola.
You know, soda, I like that. If you come up with your own brand, okay, I just don't like it when they're really lazy and it just says cola or beer on it, you know? Like, let's get into, first of all, the theatrical cut. Because what we're watching is a different movie than what we got at the theater in some ways. The theatrical version was, what, 2 hours, 15 minutes, something like that?
2 hours, 30 minutes.
I was about to say, it was up over the 2.5 hour mark, I'm pretty sure.
So about 2.5 hours. And one thing that I thought was obvious from watching the Ultimate Edition is that, boy, oh boy, did they go crazy with the editing on this one. But let's forget about the Ultimate Edition and pretend we have not seen that yet. First of all, let's talk about the theatrical edition. What was your reaction, first of all, when you left the theater, and as the months have gone by of reflection? Nick, let's start with you.
Well, if you remember that week, the critical hammer kind of got dropped on this movie in the days leading up to the release, and so I think we were all kind of, not that we were expecting it to be beloved by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we were all kind of taken aback by the degree of the beating which it received, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so walking into the theater, I walked out, and my thoughts were, I can see the issues that some would have with it, but there are things in this movie that I cannot be objective about, that I cannot be unbiased towards. And so I walk out going, for me as a DC Comics fan, extremely effective, but I can see how as a movie it might not be. Over time, however, you start to think about, you know, it's utility as a movie more than you do as a piece of fan service, and that has caused it to slip in my mind somewhat. I still don't think it deserved the beating it got. I think there is more good than bad here, even in the theatrical cut, which, I granted, now I haven't seen the theatrical cut since WrestleMania weekend, but I feel like there was more good than bad there. I thought it was a B+. It was a solid movie. Nothing spectacular per se, but just really didn't deserve the hatred it got, I thought.
And real quick, we got a few minutes ago while you were talking the first of what is a recurring thematic or imagery in the movie, which is a horse who like knees up and walks away, gallops away. And there are that's one thing that I noticed watching the Ultimate Edition is there are several recurrences of horses in this movie, which is kind of a weird. I know that that's you know there's a famous horse scene in Dark Knight Returns.
Right. But, the first time I saw the movie, I kept waiting for Bruce to mount one of the horses.
Right, right.
And not in a sexual way, of course.
No, no. That would certainly, if it happened, would have to be at a medium pace.
Indeed.
Real quick, from my end, the theatrical cut, I think when I left the theater, I was just kind of, to borrow a phrase from Young Justice, I was whelmed. I wasn't over or underwhelmed. I was just.
I must interject here to inform you on my wife's behalf. That isn't a phrase from Young Justice. That phrase was first coined in the classic teen film 10 Things I Hate About You, and Young Justice directly lifted it.
Well, hey, I did not realize that. I will say, however, that 10 Things I Hate About You is related to comics in an ancillary way through the casting of Heath Ledger. So. Another story for another time. But the I thought that it was just – to me, I left the theater and I said, you know, that was okay. I thought it could have been significantly better. I thought right. It could have been significantly worse. There were things I loved about the movie, which we'll talk about as we go through this footage here. And there were things that I hated about the movie. And so it kind of canceled out for me into kind of an average experience. And as the months have gone on, and actually I will say this as well as a little spoiler alert, after watching the Ultimate Edition, it actually made me like the theatrical version even less.
Yeah, let's save that.
But we'll save that. Russell, theatrical version when you left the theater and on reflection.
Well, this is a movie that I went back to the theater to see 4 times, and that was. You know, that should give you an indication as to where I was. Because, I mean, I was seeing Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman on screen together for mm-hmm. the first time. And I will admit, I was caught up in a lot of the hype of the movie. And there was a hype train for this movie that was like a jumbo on a high-speed rail.
Yeah.
And that is something that Warner Brothers did very well was hype. They hyped the ever-living shit out of this movie. And, you know, to its detriment, actually. And that's something I feel they've also done to Suicide Squad, but that's another subject. But when I came out of the theater, I wrote a review that you can also find right on placetobenation.com. Shameless self-plug in full
effect. Only place to be in your pop culture world.
Thank you, Greg. And my initial reaction was I gave it a 4 star out of 5 for the theatrical cut. Now, in the months that have passed since and after multiple viewings and thinking back on it, and like Nick said, approaching it more as a movie rather than as DC Comics fan service, my score today, as I have said on other podcasts, including my own, I would drop it to a 3 out of 5. And Greg, I think I'm going to be right where you are when it comes to the Ultimate Edition versus the theatrical cut, in that my view of the theatrical cut has actually gone down to probably about a 2.5 star out of 5 when compared to the Ultimate Edition and what this movie could have been as a result of that.
Right. And right now we're seeing on screen one of the many, many improvements and additions into the extended cut. In the first half of the movie in particular, which is we're seeing more backstory for this part was actually in the theatrical cut, but we have seen to this point more backstory, more reasoning, more of an overall point to this Lois stuff in Africa. We're seeing the actual machinations going on behind this CIA operation that introduces the ill-fated version of Jimmy Olsen that they have in the movie.
Yes, we are seeing CIA agent Jimmy Olsen, which pairs well with supermodel Jimmy Olsen from Supergirl, because just doing Jimmy Olsen apparently is impossible.
Poor Jimmy Olsen, he's had a rough cinematic life in the last few years.
We sit here and we get upset with mischaracterizations of Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, and somewhere David Sunday is angrily shaking his fist at CIA agent Jimmy Olsen.
But the cool thing about what we're seeing here is this adds a whole new layer to the movie, because it shows you that Lex Luthor's grand scheme that he sets into motion in the theatrical version, which quite frankly is lacking in context, which is the word I was struggling for a few minutes ago, by the way, when I just babbled incoherently and left large silences. Context. We are given context for Lois's role in the movie, for Lex's role in the movie, for Lex's overall plan to put all of this in motion. We're in the middle of Africa, and Lois is seeing Jimmy get killed, and here the government is ready to throw in a bomb to, you know, take care of folks. We're actually going to see a scene in a second where Superman actually intercepts the bombs, which is really cool and should have been in the theatrical cut, because one of the things that I didn't like in the theatrical cut is we never really got any context for Superman.
And here we're seeing that horse riding scene that was used in nearly every trailer for the movie but was not in the theatrical cut.
Yes, there's actually a couple of those in this that were in trailers that were not in the theatrical cut. Yes, horse riding. Another instance of horses, by the way.
Yes.
So, which we'll see a few more times.
Maybe that was their answer to having, you know, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo having Bruce Wayne full on punch horses, or having them set on fire in their opening story arc of Batman.
Yes, yes. Snyder and Capullo and their hatred of horses for some reason. But
did we ever think we'd live in a world where the freaking KG Beast of all people was brought to life on screen, by the way?
Yes.
I did not. At least I kind of figured if anywhere he would wind up in Suicide Squad with a bomb in his head.
Suicide Squad, yeah.
But here's the thing. Did everybody actually know that that was the KG Beast when they were watching the movie? I think I had to be told afterwards that that's who that was.
I did, but I had read that online previously.
Because he's not wearing the KG Beast mask or anything like that, so it's really,
right. But then you have to they drop the name in the
right,
the real name of the character. And that's something we just saw that we should call out is the flamethrower scene.
Oh my god!
Or the flamethrower sequence,
so important.
So important, yes. and then is called back to later in the movie, which makes you view that entire Martha Kent scene through a different set of eyes. The implication being that part of Lex's plan is to make it seem as if Superman murdered his own mother. Like, it's so important. Okay, let's not bury the lead here.
Yep.
And there was the guy that everybody thought was Hal Jordan.
Right. But let's not bury the lead. Let me get this out of the way. What the fuck was Zack Snyder thinking? Like, I understand that you can't put out a 3-hour summer blockbuster. I get it. I understand that. But of all the things to cut in this movie, he chose these scenes. These scenes that aren't just subplots. They are the
story. They are the story.
They are integral. They cannot be removed. The story doesn't make sense in a lot of ways without them. And he freaking cut them in favor of gratuitous freaking the nightmare sequence, which is one of the most useless things in this freaking movie, and a terrible, I'm going to say it, terrible Flash cameo that I actually was able to rewatch for the first time since the theater and actually understand what he's saying. And if we get there, I'll rant about how terrible that is.
And I'll interject here and say that if you were to cut all of that, including the Flash cameo from the movie, you shaved off 6 minutes.
Yep.
You cut 6 minutes out of your movie right there. And you can't tell me that there's not some fluff within some of these extended action sequences or in other little places that you couldn't have gotten this movie down to 2 hours, 45 minutes and put it in theaters, and it would have been just fine.
Yep. You can't lose this part, though. I mean, that's
no,
the flamethrower. As soon
this
as I saw the
right here.
You know, the guy that I need to be apologizing to is the screenwriter. What's his name again, Russell?
Chris Terrio.
Chris Terrio.
Chris Terrio. I need to apologize to Chris Terrio because I've been giving him a hard time. After the theatrical cut, I said, wow, that script was bad. That was not – that was just such – it was held together by Elmer's glue, essentially. But, man, this Ultimate Edition
– And this character who's on screen.
Yes.
Who they completely, like – give you a whole other perspective on in the Ultimate Cut that isn't there in the theatrical edition.
For those who aren't following along, this is the lady who claims that Superman brought fire from the sky and led to her family being killed when he rescues Lois from the terrorists in Africa.
Which they never show you in theatrical cut. So when she's talking in the theatrical cut, you kind of go like, what the fuck is this bitch babbling about?
Yeah, exactly. You're like – my thought when I saw it is, okay, her family died and she probably doesn't know that it wasn't Superman that did it, and maybe there was crossfire, or maybe her – I assumed her family were part of the rebels that kidnapped Lois, and that she was saying that Superman killed the rebels, which he didn't. Which is what she's saying, I guess, but through the flamethrower. The flamethrower scene adds so much context to everything.
It does. That's the entire plot of the movie at the beginning.
They basically
removed the plot. Hey, so if your biggest problem with the theatrical cut, like if you did not like the movie or were lukewarm on it, was the fact that, you know, it felt like the plot was missing, watch this Ultimate Edition and it will be like a light bulb just went on. It's like, oh my God, there it is.
Hey guys, and I want to call out real quick just because it's happening. It just happened on screen. That football scene, that bizarre football scene that they held on for a long time.
Yeah.
That was actually the first thing that was ever shot for the movie before it was.
Yep.
It got that massive delay, and they spent millions on it, and it is relegated to essentially a deleted scene for the Ultimate Edition.
And
that just goes to show you why this movie.
And apparently,
Warner Brothers,
Gotham's football team is horrible, by the way.
Horrible. They're getting the shit kicked out of them. And I had read somewhere that was supposed to be a backdoor Cyborg introduction as well, but I don't know if that was actually the case or not.
That's hard. Yeah, that's hard to say because they don't even in this Ultimate Edition, they don't show you hardly anything of it. It's a total waste. And honestly, that's another part of this movie that I feel like could have been cut. Like we could have gone right back into the way the theatrical cut did it with the introduction of Batman here. Didn't need that football scene at all. It's total fluff. Although I will credit it for one thing. It shows the lack of concern that Gotham City Police have for the people of Gotham, because those two guys could hardly be bothered to do much of anything until they were basically told, hey, get off your ass and go do your job.
Exactly. They were much more concerned about the football game.
See, I don't have a problem with fluff in a alternate cut of the movie, because what an alternate cut of a movie, in my opinion anyway, should be is just a version of the movie that takes what was in the theatrical cut and just stretches it out a little bit and adds some things that aren't really necessary. What this, like we've just said though, this is adding things that never should have been removed in the first place. This isn't an alternate cut of the movie. This is the movie, as far as I'm concerned.
And, exactly. And I will say this for the football scene, even though I don't get much out of it, it does play kind of an integral part to Clark Kent's story a little bit later. Even though you don't I guess you don't necessarily need to see it. The whole like Kent go cover sports, or I got you on this football game part. I felt like it added a little bit more context to what Perry White has to say.
Well, not to get too nerdy and not to get too detail oriented with it, but I'll counter with White actually says Gotham stopped 5 yards from glory, and I don't think 59-0 is 5 yards from glory.
No, it's not. And I'd also like to point out that in my closed captions, somebody else just dropped an F-bomb.
I missed that.
This cop just dropped an oh fuck as he walks into the room and sees old homeboy strapped to a what looks like an old style heater. And there's our first appearance of the Batman. Flying
now,
around.
This is really cool. This is one of the better sequences in the movie, in my opinion.
It's a great scene, yeah, definitely.
While
Russell mentioned it, you know, the language. That seems to be the only reason why this Ultimate Edition got an R rating is the – I mean, maybe there's some more gratuitous violence in terms of gunshots in the nightmare sequence, but I didn't notice them if there were, and really it's just a couple of F-bombs.
There's blood spray in the desert that wasn't there, but honestly, some of that had to be digitally removed in the theatrical cut, and I don't see why you couldn't have done it here, because it's a bit unnecessary, because all you really need to see is, could hear gunfire and then skip to the flamethrower part,
and
you're good.
Let's be honest. If you were going to get an R-rated version of this movie, I feel like there's a place to earn it.
And the place to earn it is right here.
Is right here. Bathtub scene. Right now.
Because we all intended to see all of Henry Cavill, right?
Right.
That's where we're going with that.
I wanted to see...
that's the ticket.
I wanted to see Little Cal.
Yes.
I'd be Big Cal for all I know.
Right, exactly. It has nothing to do with Amy Adams or her proximity to the tub. But, you know, I agree. I was like... When I watched this, I was like, I've seen PG-13 movies that had a lot worse in them than this had.
In terms of violence, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It just blew my mind. I mean, Expendables 3 was a PG-13 movie, and the violence was way more excessive than it was in this movie, in my opinion.
It was. I'll agree with that. And with Expendables 3, you could still tell they shot an R-rated movie and edited it down.
Yes, exactly.
But here, I don't think that they ever intended for this movie to be an R-rated, and they probably thought like we did as they were shooting it. They were like, oh, this will probably get a PG-13. I mean, it'd be dark, yeah, but it's not in danger of getting an R rating. And then they were probably shocked as hell whenever they got one.
And I've mentioned this on a podcast before. I don't remember which one, but one of the things that Kevin Smith has talked about oftentimes is the arduous and, frankly, expensive appeal process before the MPAA. So I could very easily envision a scenario where they were like, all right, we already know we've got to cut this movie down for theatrical anyway. If they slap our alternate cut with an R rating, what do we really care? What does that really matter in the long run? Because we've got our PG-13 that we wanted for theatrical. So why bother fighting an alternate rating, essentially.
Yeah, and again, for those of you who may buy this R-rated edition looking for more blood or boobs or whatever you're looking for, you're not going to get it. It's very much content-wise the same as what you got in the theater in terms of violence and all that stuff. And again, I feel it's really a disservice to the movie to even give it an R rating, but...
It is. And on that note, Greg, I'd like to point something out, too. That
yes, absolutely.
If people are going into this Ultimate Edition, especially people who didn't like the theatrical cut, and they're like expecting this to completely change their view of the movie, the only way that's going to happen is if your number one problem with the film was the seeming lack of coherence in story and or Jesse Eisenberg, the Lex Luthor side of things, seeming to rely more on blind luck than on a master plan, because the
and
rest
also
of the movie's
a lack
there.
Of well, and I would say a lack of a subplot for Lois Lane and Clark Kent. I think both of those characters are given much more to do in the Ultimate Edition.
Oh, absolutely.
Than they are in the theatrical cut. Like, but I think what you're driving at is if your main issue with this movie is the tone or the characterization of these characters,
right,
and you're expecting this to solve that, it's not going to do that.
Not at all.
This is a take. This is Zack Snyder's take on this mythos. You either are on board with it or you aren't. And I'm not saying that, like, you're wrong for not being on board with it. I'm saying that this version of the movie isn't going to rectify those types of concerns.
Correct. And, that's... I love what you mentioned about Clark and Lois, because they definitely benefit the most from this extended edition, especially Lois, who I already was defending her role in the theatrical cut. I thought she was clearly the driving heroic force in the movie, the one person who was actually trying to find the truth of matters. But in this version, let's face it, Lois is the world's greatest detective.
Yes.
She's the one that basically figures out everything and makes this whole thing unravel.
Right. She is the glue that really pulls the plot together, holds it together. But for my money, and to play off of what Nick said, Clark Kent, journalist. Freaking finally.
But not an ounce of it in the theatrical cut.
No, it was all removed.
Literally, you cut from Perry giving him an assignment, to him just refusing to do the assignment.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, you get no implication of what he's doing.
It just made him look like a bad employee.
Absolutely.
And this makes him look like a really good reporter. And I was like, yes, finally, we're seeing the Clark Kent that I know, that I love and want to see on screen. The crusader of social justice. Thank you.
Yep. And most importantly, a Clark Kent that you can understand what Lois sees in him.
Absolutely.
In the theatrical version, you're like, okay, Lois is smart as a whip. She's great at her job. And this is a guy who just mopes around all the time and doesn't seem to do anything well. He doesn't superhero well, and he doesn't report well.
What we're seeing right now on screen is the first appearance of Ben Affleck outside of the suit in the movie. And so I guess we should probably take a moment to address that massive casting controversy that was way back when.
Yes, and before we get into that, what is the timestamp on both of your movies?
Oh,
I don't know. I am at 29 minutes 34 seconds. So I'm actually seeing
Yep,
that's what I'm at right as well. Yeah.
So yeah, let's get in. That's another ball of wax there. But let's get into Ben Affleck. I was one of those, and Russell, I think you were one of those as well. And Nick, I think we were all on board with this from the get go. I liked it. I thought it made sense to me. I'm an Affleck fan. I've been an Affleck fan for years. I defended Affleck's performance in Daredevil. Not the movie, his performance in it. I've defended his performance in pretty much all of his movies, even his bad movies. I've never seen a movie and I thought, boy, Ben Affleck's performance is the reason that movie sucks.
We cannot forget the fundamental fact of life, which is Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms, yo.
Damn right. And I'll say another of my guilty pleasure Ben Affleck movies, Reindeer Games.
Reindeer Games.
I'll give you one that I can acknowledge is a shitty movie, Paycheck.
I love it. Yeah, I dig Paycheck, man. John Woo.
John Woo?
I believe it's John Woo. Is it not John Woo? I think it is.
I'm pretty sure it is. Now, Greg, you even
defend Jersey Girl, and I don't even defend Jersey Girl.
I love Jersey Girl. I don't defend Jersey Girl. I love Jersey Girl is my favorite Kevin Smith movie alongside Dogma.
I won't go that far, but I will say that I'm with Greg that I enjoy Jersey Girl quite a bit.
Yeah, and Affleck's – that's not even touching the movies he's directed. Gone Baby Gone.
Yeah, I mean, people dump on Affleck for shit that happened 10, 15 years ago.
And
like, they don't dump on him for current creative output, which is, like you said, Gone Baby Gone, Argo, The Town. I mean, just Gone Girl.
Which
are all just outstanding performances, outstanding directorial efforts, outstanding scripting efforts alongside Chris Terrio in some instances. He's not a screenwriter, but he is responsible for helping to break story, quote-unquote. So, I mean, there are lots of things that the dude has done in the last 5 or 6 years that people should be praising him for, not slamming him. But that's the nature of the internet, you know. Once something sucks, it always sucks, and it can never be redeemed, in their opinion.
And that is unfortunate because I'm with Greg. Like, I was with the at first the Affleck casting seemed a little odd to me because I thought what was going to happen was they were going to go for a younger Batman, like we were legit starting over with that character, but when they made the case for what they were trying to do, and in the context of that we had just had an older Batman in The Dark Knight Rises, I was like, okay, you basically had always intended to have an older Batman because that's kind of where people were left off with The Dark Knight Rises. And since you weren't tying all of that in, you still wanted to keep that element going. And the fact is, the most popular Batman story, the biggest selling Batman story of all time, is The Dark Knight Returns. And if, you know, I read some and even heard some criticism that they did not like this take on Batman. I mean, though rare though that was, I can only say to those people, if you didn't want this take on Batman, you shouldn't have spent the last 30 years making Dark Knight Returns the biggest selling Batman story of all time.
Right. There's something that the general audiences seem to connect with about an older, grizzled Batman that they went with. And frankly, I found it a little bit refreshing that they went with this take on Batman because, it's not like there's any dearth of young guy becomes superhero movies. You know, we get it in Marvel all the time. We've gotten in DC plenty of times. We've seen Batman Begin, literally.
What the fuck is happening on screen?
Oh
right
my
now?
God, this is my least favorite scene in the whole movie.
The Jolly Rancher scene, the infamous Jesus. Jolly Rancher, and you know that's one thing that I still have an issue with, even in this cut, because I see what Lex is getting out of all of this, but I don't really get what Mr. Junior Senator here is getting.
The only implication I can get is that he is of the same mind as Lex and that there is a need for a state-sponsored alien deterrent. And so he views Lex as the only real way to get down that path. But again, that is something that you have to infer.
And it is weird. I mean, there's no way of getting around the weirdness of the fact that he just let another dude put a Jolly Rancher in his mouth.
None whatsoever. But I will give him credit here in the Ultimate Edition for the scene right after that where instead of shirtless Clark watching TV and, being like, that's my first introduction to the horribleness of Batman. He's actually seeing the report of that the lady from Africa talking about wanting to speak to Superman directly, or here's what she would say if she met him. And I was like, that is so much more effective than here's Batman's branding of a criminal.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you on that, Russell. That's a great point because – this again, that word again, context. There's so much more context now to why Superman behaves the way he does, to why Batman behaves the way he does, to why Lex, to a degree, behaves the way he does, to why Lois behaves the way that she does. There's just so much more context in what we're seeing now.
And credit to them. I know that you're not a fan of the Lex Luthor take, but they extended his introduction a little bit. The story that he tells about his father and growing up under the influence of third world dictators. And I thought that the extended version of his speech was more effective because it provided more context.
I would agree completely. I guess we should just transition into that now is as good a time as any. Because I do agree with you on that. It does give you more context for him. Unfortunately for me, it's still a take on Lex Luthor that I cannot get behind. If anything, I enjoyed the rest of this extended cut so much that he was still the one thing that was like an albatross around the movie for me.
I do not understand the unending obsession with doing a version of the Gene Hackman take on Lex Luthor over and over and over again on film.
By which you mean the kind of awkward, comedic,
borderline neurotic,
comedic kind of goofy almost take on Lex, where
all
his inflection
this movie was
goes
missing.
Up like this, and
all this movie was missing was a wacky real estate scheme. that's all it was missing.
Which we've gotten in so many Superman movies.
Because as we all know, there's nothing more evil in the world than real estate tycoon. Because that's the most evil business you can be in. It sank our economy in 2008. We could totally bring this back, right?
Real estate, the ultimate evil in the DC universe. Apparently. But
maybe that's it. Maybe that's the key. Maybe that's what they could have made people love Man of Steel if Zod had only had a wacky real estate team,
Zod,
which he kind of did. Come to think of it, he was landscaping the earth.
Oh my God! It's all connected.
Zod walks into the courthouse and starts trying to negotiate for a deed to to some plot of land in New York.
Getting back to the movie, I'm on a different scene now where Clark is in Gotham.
Right.
Oh, yes.
He is introduced to he goes to actually try and talk to the lady from Africa who we just keep referring to her as that. But he goes to where
– who has an apartment in Gotham for some reason?
Yeah, it's like she's living in this really shitty part of Gotham. Not that – it has a lot of bright spots apparently from this movie. But – he goes to try and find her, and this old dude in a wheelchair is like, she's not here. But then he's the guy that tells Clark about Batman. Like, that was Clark's actual first instance of hearing about Batman in this movie.
Yes, and that's another scene that was in one of the trailers that got cut out, and it's so essential. Russell, when I saw this scene, I was like, A, that's Clark Kent being a good reporter, and B, we finally have context for why Superman stupidly falls into Lex's hands.
And it's as we'll find out later, we may not get to that in the podcast, but as we see later, that dude in the wheelchair is actually working for Lex.
Mm-hmm.
He is paid off by KG Beast and is an essential part of this plan.
And we also see later on that the lady, who I'll refer to as the lady from both Gotham and Africa, she is also part of Lex's payroll, essentially.
Yeah,
she lied about the whole thing.
Yeah, she was paid off, and she grows a conscience later. And actually, this is another thing that the Ultimate Edition does. It gives a broader story for Senator Finch, who has done a bit of disservice in the theatrical cut, but actually looks way smarter and a lot braver in the Ultimate Edition, because mm-hmm. we get more context for her story. Because as it turns out, in the Capitol scene and just before she unfortunately meets her demise, she's about to blow the lid off.
Yeah,
she's about to call out Lex, and
she's got Lex dead to rights.
She's got it.
I agree.
And that also, we know now in the Ultimate Edition that poor guy in the wheelchair was a patsy set up by Lex.
Did that change? Knowing that, is that different from how you perceive the theatrical cut? Because it was for me.
It was
the theatrical
for me
cut. I assumed he was essentially a suicide bomber.
That's how I took it too. Like, it was.
No, I had always assumed that because the bomb was in the wheelchair, it was something Lex related. But I didn't think that the theatrical cut did a good enough job of establishing the links that Lex had gone to conceal his efforts from Superman. The line about the wheelchair being lined with lead is, once again, to use the word, essential. Cannot be removed. Should have never been removed. Should have been off the table mm-hmm. for editing.
And another
should
great,
have been a non
all of Jenna Malone's scenes should yep. have been left in the movie, because it made no sense to cut her. She was essential to Lois's plot. She's essential to the plot, and we're going to keep using essential. That's what we should just start. We should just call this Batman v Superman the essential.
The essential edition. That's exactly right. And it's not a situation.
I'm just going to start calling it Batman v Superman, and that's it. That's all I'm going to call it. It's the only version of the movie that should be watched by any human being.
And it should be watched by – I think it should be watched by more people who were not fans of the theatrical cut, just to try it out, just to see if it maybe works.
To play devil's advocate a little bit, though, is the onus on Zack Snyder for, making terrible edits, which I actually think it is, but – is there not some blame to throw back at Chris Terrio to say, don't write a 300-page script?
I'm going to say that
– or excuse me, a 200-page script in this instance.
I don't throw Zach under the bus quite like that. My feeling is that Warner Brothers is more to blame there than Zach is. Zach is more of a guy who's more of a team player. Like, he really gets on board maybe a little too fast with what the studio tells him to do. And I got the impression that he shot his movie his way. And when the studio came back and said, nah, this is too long, we're sending in our editors to start cutting this movie down. Because, that's the editor's job, is to make the movie fit. So I look at over at the editing credits, and I'm like, there's the guy that I'm going to point to and say, you made the call on this and put this movie together. Yes, Zach deserves some credit because he is the director, and he still had to say,
and it's his,
okay,
his final name, his name yeah. on the final
and it,
product.
And it is his name.
And he had to know, common sense dictates that in today's day and age, they're not going to put out a major studio blockbuster that's over
three hours. Right.
Person alive who can get away with that is Peter Jackson.
And I would make,
and that's the only one.
I would make the argument that
also a Warner Brothers Wunderkind.
Yes. I would make the argument that if you need 3 hours to make a superhero movie, you're probably and it's not Crisis on Infinite Earths or the Infinity Gauntlet, then you probably need to shorten it down, because I think 2.5 is kind of the sweet spot. That's kind of like the max that I look at for one of these movies. If you're getting to 3 hours, you're getting into the epics of the 60s territory, and that's kind of not necessarily what you want for a what you're hoping to be your tentpole blockbuster. However, the editing is really the big key, because even if the script writer is writing what he thinks is the best story, and if you go through and you look at this movie, a lot of the time consumption is action scenes or visual cues that go on maybe a little bit too long. And we've talked about the nightmare sequence, which we haven't gotten to yet, but the nightmare sequence just screams unnecessary.
This this nightmare scene that Bruce has,
what is this? This is
another scene that I'm actually back and forth on this, because part of me is like, I get that he's still so traumatized by the death of his parents and by what he's becoming, because he is becoming something that he never intended to as Batman. And that's something that Alfred has called him out on even earlier in this movie, that he's changed as a person. And this scene here, like adding in the I got to take painkillers and drink wine, you could totally use the theatrical cut version of this and it'd be fine. And I'm kind of coming down now to say that you could probably cut that whole like nightmare bat scene.
This does add a different element to Affleck's Batman than this scene in particular, where he's in his lakeside, home, and he's in bed with a model. Because remember, in the Christian Bale portrayal movies, his public persona was the playboy, but he appeared to not really – we never really saw him follow through on that, in terms of he pretended to abscond with all these women, but we never actually saw him sleep with any of these women.
Oh, I'm convinced he had a –
Dib, dib, bloody suntan.
Like. Right.
Convinced that he had himself a three-way with those two models in Batman Begins.
Yeah.
There ain't no way he drove them home like that and did not have himself a good time.
But we see this is the first
– I'm thinking more of the Alfred and Bruce on Russian ballet gangbang that was heavily implied in The
Alfred
Dark Knight.
Didn't
personally
seem as into the Russian ballet troupe as one may have imagined. Remember, he wanted them to apply their own bloody suntan lotion. So
Alfred was far more into Lucius in Batman Begins than he was into any of those Russian ballerinas in The Dark Knight. And in my mind, there has already been a Alfred and Lucius romantic comedy.
We shipped them.
I totally put those two together, because in my mind, they're both gay in that trilogy.
That's right. The Lamborghini Densha. So this is a very much a part of his playboy Bruce Wayne persona. He's obviously still Batman inside, but we're seeing that kind of version that we often got sometimes in the comics, where Bruce would, have a different girlfriend given
speaking of which, we're into another scene that's added to the movie. That badass.
Ben Affleck, if you will. and here he goes taking the cover off of a wonderful new sports car, which is a recurring theme in Batman movies. He has awesome cars.
Indeed.
Getting back to I don't want to gloss over this too much, but the Lex thing, because I really, really enjoy this Ultimate Edition. I think it's a much better film overall. If you get away your personal takes, the one thing that just still drives me nuts is, and I'll admit, part of it is my personal bias, because I'm not saying that I want Clancy Brown from JLU and Superman the Animated Series to just come onto the screen. I'm just saying I want a serious, chilling, scary Lex Luthor that we've never really gotten in the screen, because there's no point in this movie when I am at any point, and I don't know if it's even possible for me to ever be intimidated by Jesse Eisenberg. But the route they went with the character as kind of, and he does, I'm not, it's hard for me to even blame him, because I feel like he did exactly what Zack Snyder and Chris Terrio wanted him to.
And see, that's the question I was going to ask. It's a chicken and the egg scenario, and I wonder which came first. Was it Snyder and Terrio had this take on Lex in their head, or was it Eisenberg came in and had this reading of the character? I really don't know.
Eisenberg always credits Terrio. I mean, at every turn, at every little press junket he did, it was always him saying how much he I mean, he was verbally filleting Chris Terrio in the way that we verbally fillet Jeff Johns. And
yes.
That's,
yeah, but in this case, no verbal fellatio is deserved.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know if it's hardened or softened on this take on Lex Luthor, because I appreciated it for being different, for it trying something new and not giving us the standard Lex, and certainly for not giving us Gene Hackman again, because, boy, we don't need that. But there are parts of this that I'm just, you know, not into, and I kind of rolled my eyes at his poor telling of a Greek myth in the same way that Wonder Woman does.
Right, and that scene is as bad as any of the Lex scenes in the movie, because, and again, I feel like if this was a new character they were creating for the movie, I could buy it, no problem. But you're taking Lex Luthor, a character who, in my opinion, has been done a disservice on the big screen, at least since the first, you know, I like Gene Hackman's take, I really do, but every, you know, we certainly saw Kevin Spacey do a Gene Hackman impression. We saw them go to the Lex Luthor well in every one of the Christopher Reeve Superman movies except three, where they had a Lex Luthor stand-in character that was essentially the same as Hackman's Luthor. I want a Lex that, in the comics, I've never read Lex like that. In the comics, I read Lex as a confident, calculating, coolest dude in the room.
Exactly.
Always 10 steps ahead of everyone. And
Lex's,
you know,
entire plot in this film revolves around getting the public to turn on Superman, exposing Superman for what he believes Superman truly is. Thus, by implication, setting himself up as the positive public alternative to Superman. Given the version of Lex in this movie, why would anyone in the public choose to look at this guy and go like, you know what, he seems like he's got his shit together, we should listen to him. He comes off like a borderline insane person.
Yes,
in every scene
absolutely.
He's in.
There are times where, and I don't think this was intentional for the record, I'm not accusing Eisenberg of this at all. I think Eisenberg did exactly what he was told to do and what they wanted him to do. There are times when it feels like Lex as the Joker. And that is not, they are not even close to being the same character. And there are times to me in the movie where I was like, I could see the Joker delivering that line or doing that. It's the Jolly Rancher scene. The Joker would do that. Lex wouldn't do that, in my opinion. But that's just, you know, my take on it. We haven't talked much about Henry Cavill, who did not get treated well by the theatrical version, but in this version, I thought excellent. I mean, as good as he was in Man of Steel, he didn't get as much to do still, but, you know, the again, the Ultimate Edition just gives him so much more to play with than the theatrical cut, where, I'll be honest, when I left the theater, I was like, man, that was not a good turn by Henry Cavill, only because he didn't get much to do.
Yeah, his part in the theatrical edition was, it felt underwritten. It felt like they had done exactly what was rumored going into the movie, was that the studio wanted more Batman and less Superman. So they cut the vast majority of Superman scenes and Clark scenes out of the movie. And then whenever we get this Ultimate Edition, it's like, well, there's all the stuff that gives you all that context for Clark and for Superman, and it all just makes so much more sense. And, you know, I'll say this for the movie, even the 2.5 hour version at times really did feel like the full 2.5 hours. This 3 hour version, I feel like goes by faster.
It's so funny you say that, because I agree. The actual, like, momentum of the plot is much more natural in this version.
It is, like, all the editing beats are there. The parallel, and that's something else that is completely missing from the theatrical cut, the parallels between Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent. It's displayed in so many scenes that are, like, either cut short or cut completely from the theatrical version. And then you see it on full display in the Ultimate Edition, you're like, man, this must be the version of the movie that got all those supposed standing ovations from Warner execs and other people who were like, man, this is going to finally put us on the comic book adaptation map.
Absolutely. Nick, what were your thoughts on, in particular, Superman's usage in the movie and the performance of Henry Cavill in this edition compared to theatrical?
Well, I mean, he was barely in the theatrical, so yeah. I mean, there's not much to compare it to, honestly. You know, Superman had some scenes in the theatrical, but I think Clark Kent, from my memory anyway, is virtually a non-factor in the theatrical cut. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was a good turn. He doesn't have as much to do here as he does in Man of Steel, so I think his performance was probably better in Man of Steel, honestly, just because he's, you know, he is dependent upon to carry the movie, and he reflects that in his performance. Here, I think he's fine. I don't think he's great by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think he is he's terrible. The term wooden has gotten thrown at him a lot for his Superman, and that's not something I agree with in the least. So hopefully anybody who said that about him based solely on the theatrical
will watch this one. Yeah, agreed, because he gets a lot more to do here.
Can I just remark on the visual orgasm that is that scene of him hauling the giant ship through the ice?
That was reminiscent of...
I actually like this one with the space capsule a little bit.
I love all of this. This whole montage is amazing. But that whenever I saw,
but Russell, you know for a fact that Superman never saves anyone in the Zack Snyder universe.
I know, it's insane. Like, right? There's nobody being saved here. He's arriving just to, like, you know, let people die. Like,
yeah,
that's totally what
he's showing
doing
up here just to mock these people for landing on their roof.
How about
peasants who can't fly?
which I wish that every Superman movie would have an alternate edition of early Superman 3 Superman going around and just undoing all the good things that he did earlier in the movie.
thus the inspiration for superdickery.com. There you go.
Restarts the earthquakes and whatnot, you know. But this is a great montage that has a lot of throwbacks to classic Superman scenes from the comics. You know, everybody has their version. Every artist has their version of Superman pulling a ship in the ocean. We've seen it recently in the pages of Superman. We saw it in Superman Unchained as well.
I want to remark on something that's coming up here. This is an additional scene in the movie where Clark has been watching all those newscasts talking about, you know, can or should there be a Superman? And at the end of it, he calls home. He calls his mom. This is an additional Martha Kent scene. And I adored this. I was like, this is what I wanted to see happen, because this actually runs in parallel to something that happened earlier, that nightmare scene with Bruce, because it was the grave of Martha Kent that explodes open. And we see that Bruce is still being haunted by the demons of his dead mother, his dead parents. But when Clark is feeling haunted or overwhelmed, he doesn't try to run away necessarily from his parents. He runs to them, and
still has his mom there to help him out. You know,
it's a great.
Oh, and here's Jenna Malone, as you were referencing earlier.
Yes, an essential again part of the plot. What's so special? Because we never know what's special about that bullet in the theatrical cut. Nobody cares.
And not Barbara Gordon, for the
yes,
record.
Yes, not at all Barbara Gordon, though possibly equally smart, because she is a forensic scientist. You know, if you're familiar with Barry Allen Flash, she kind of has a similar job. And I love seeing Lois exercise some of those some of those angles, some of those connections that she has. She is a resourceful reporter.
And if there's one criticism that I'm sick of hearing about this movie and about Man of Steel, I'm so tired of people criticizing Amy Adams as Lois, because she's playing Lois the way Lois is supposed to be played. And I feel like people, if they watch this Ultimate Edition, you're going to get the best theatrical Lois Lane that you've ever gotten. In my opinion, I know that's controversial, because I have an affinity for Margot Kidder in the first Superman movie as well.
Sure.
But this is, in my opinion, the most complete Lois Lane we've ever gotten in a film. Now, I know the TV versions have been awesome, but in a film, this is the best we've gotten. Easy.
And how about this this scene that we just got to? Man, they've added so much. In the first two acts of this movie, they add so much. But I thought that scene with the guy that Batman branded at the beginning – being brought to Metropolis and put in that prison, and he's freaking out. He's like, you know, you can't put me in here because the Bat Brand means that somebody's going to be like gunning for me and going to try and kill me.
And the KG Beast visits.
And then it turns out, it's all part of Lex's plan. He's been paying off criminals on the inside to kill anybody with the Bat Brand so that he can keep goading Superman and trying to build this fight. And I was like, that is yet another part of this plot that whenever you cut it out, you do this movie nothing but disservice. Like, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Like, you are cutting your nose off to spite your face.
Exactly. Or in the case of Scoot McNairy's character, you're cutting off your legs entirely.
Yeah, it's cutting the legs out from under you. Because there's the scene. Here is the scene now. He's KG Beast is paying this this random criminal off in prison, saying, you know, go get this guy. And he's totally about to get shivved.
This actually might be one of the things that led to the R rating, by the way, this scene.
And then,
the stabbing, they hold on it. Not that they show the actual stabbing, but it is a brutal shivving, if you will.
It is, and they could have shot this a little differently, made it a little shorter, because, I mean, you can get your point across without going this brutal.
Because they went, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Eight stabs.
Yeah, like 8 stabs to the gut. So that might be one of the things I'm thinking.
And it's like you could have totally just had him, like, shove the guy against a wall or something, and that totally would have gotten your point across. You didn't need all that.
Have I mentioned that I love when we do these off the pages and I get to see the subtitles because I get to see things like, in parentheses, indistinct shouting? Love it.
And this scene that we're seeing right now in the theatrical cut, if you'll remember, was actually way earlier in the movie.
Yep. That's another thing that we haven't really talked about. Some of these scenes are arranged differently in the Ultimate Edition, and especially with regards to something you mentioned, Russell, about paralleling Bruce and Clark. That is done so much better in this version.
Yep, it's all done deliberately. Like, you see, this is the original order of scenes that Zack Snyder put together. And this is how the movie was originally intended to flow. And moving them out of order does nothing but make the movie confusing.
One point that I was going to make earlier is this is becoming a bit of a trend with Zack Snyder movies, in that we all of us agree that the preferred version of Watchmen is the director's cut over the theatrical cut. But the difference being, the theatrical cut is still a good movie, and it still tells its story in a cohesive manner. In this case, the extended edition is, or the director's cut, if you will, is so much more essential even than Watchmen. Like, with Watchmen, I can still watch the theatrical cut and be fine. With this, I don't ever want to see the theatrical cut again.
Yeah, the extended edition is the only edition of this movie to watch. If you're one of those people that was like turned off by the low Rotten Tomatoes aggregate score and decided to stay home or wait for video, this is the only edition of the movie you should watch.
Was this John Stewart scene added in too?
Yes, this is actually a scene in the movie that I feel like could have been left out. Like, this was one of the few parts that I was like, yeah, this is fluff and purely so. Like, I wouldn't have picked up this scene until right here when this guy is already walking the floor. Like, this is where I would have picked it up and cut the rest of that.
Right, but I feel like, you know, they kind of figured they got the DVD, fuck it, throw everything they got there.
Exactly. I was just thinking that, you know, in my head, as I've gone along in this movie several times, like, I would have kept this extent.
Trying to get it down to under 240,
right,
which is kind of what
I like, keep it to that 245. I was like, there's a little bit of fluff that's about a minute or so that I could have, like, sliced. And
one character who I don't think has anything else added to, but is absolutely phenomenal, is this character, Diana, as played by Gal Gadot.
Yeah, this scene was actually extended for her. Like, this part, her walking up to the sword, is where the theatrical cut is. But that part before it, where she, the guy's telling her the story of, you know, a mad, like, basically, you know, a mad king. Like, he's insane. That's actually
fits the theme of the movie.
Yeah, it's part of the theme of the movie and would have been great to have in the theatrical cut.
Absolutely. And she is just absolutely stunning, not just aesthetically, but also her performance is just stunning in this movie. Like, she pops off the screen every time she's on it. Her chemistry in particular with Affleck is just off the charts. Like they play off of each other so well. She looks like she's not getting blown off the screen by him, if that makes sense, because he's a big movie star. And at the end of this, she was not. She comes off like a big movie star in this. Like she just dominates every scene that she's in.
Not one bit of intimidation on her part. She is not intimidated by him.
She's perfect, and the chemistry between the two is honestly like the one thing that gives me the most hope about Justice League. Knowing that based on what we've seen thus far, those two appear to be the central two figures, at least in the early part of that story.
And as it should be, because they, they're going to be the team builders. And just the little bit of the stuff that we've seen of them in Justice League was just spot on. Just I loved that little bit.
Agreed. And it seems like their chemistry here in these scenes reminds me of the chemistry between the characters on the animated series on Justice League.
Justice League JLE. Yeah.
I'm just blown away every time that I see her as Diana.
We're coming up on the nightmare scene. See, this part of the movie, this little bit right here, I would have kept, like, decrypting, like, have it go to that. But right here where it's going to cut to the nightmare scene, and you could even do it because there's this long pause right here, this long pause before the nightmare mm-hmm. scene starts. You could cut from that to the next scene, which is Clark receiving the newspaper clip or the photos of the dead criminal. And the whole justice thing. And when he gets to the end of that, you cut back to the Batcave, and all decrypted, we've just cut 6 minutes out of the movie.
All right, let's. I think we can all agree this easily could have been lost. But it's difficult to say it can be lost and then also be like, praise the movie for being fan service in a way, because we did just get a freaking giant Omega symbol and what appears to be the fire pits of apocalypse opened up on Earth. So there's some cool imagery here. It's just to spend as much time
unnecessary.
On it
as I have unnecessary. I have several problems with this whole scene. Like, the imagery is awesome, don't get me wrong, but you could have lost it. Like, ultimately, if the reason that you're putting something in is pure fan service, if you've got just a can't miss movie around it, fine. But this is purely here to kind of tease things for the future, and I don't like that, because this needed to be a cohesive story. This kills the momentum of the plot to this point.
It really does. It drags the whole thing down, because this is supposed to be Batman versus Superman, and this whole thing is nothing but, hey, guess where we're going? We're totally going to Darkseid and all the minions of Apocalypse, and it's like, you could have not done this and just left in the communion scene, and I think the fans would have figured it out.
And
they didn't
push
Thanos this hard in Avengers.
No, and I have to say,
they didn't push him that hard, and they actually showed him on screen
exactly
in a post-credit scene, and then again in Guardians of the Galaxy, and it hasn't been beaten over the head the way the Darkseid connection was in this.
And
movie.
I have to say, I don't want to be that guy that holds on, and I'm not usually, that holds on to these really specific things, but I think that there are things that are essential to the modern tellings of characters that make them who they are. I cannot get my head around, as I know him in my generation and not in the 1940s, I can't get my head around Batman doing this and pulling a Jason Bourne and pulling out a handgun and just mowing guys down like he's Bond or Jason Bourne. That's not Batman to me. I had a huge – even though it's in a nightmare sequence, to me, this is a great – and see, you guys know how much I love action movies. This is a great action scene. It's an outstanding fight scene, but Batman is just gunning guys down. He just shot somebody with a machine gun and another guy.
Oh, but they're parademons, Greg.
This is another thing.
Your argument is irrelevant. There are parademons on screen.
It was too much for me, man. Too much.
I agree as well. I just wanted to.
The parademons are awesome, no doubt.
The design of the parademons is right on. I'm all good with that. But this whole scene is a mess. This is nothing but a grossly overdone mess.
It's gratuitous.
It is.
When people criticize Zack Snyder for having a certain aesthetic to his movies, this is the most Zack Snyder thing in this movie.
This is how it came off to me. It came off to me as if Zack Snyder said, "Boy, this would be a badass action scene. Let's just put it in there."
Right.
And honestly, I've heard one other interpretation of this scene, and it's one that, while in my mind it can make it a little better, it still doesn't make me want this scene in the movie. Is that what we're seeing is an amalgamation of both a future world that the Flash is time traveling back from and Bruce's fears of what Superman could become. And the two have become intertwined and in creating this.
Mm-hmm. I think you almost have to view it as that, Russell. And the reason for that is coming up here in a minute whenever the Flash makes his cameo. And I think you'll be able to see it with subtitles pretty easily. I'm going to wait for it so that when it happens, I'll explain why I have such a big issue with it. But the fundamental point of this plot, of the conflict between these two characters, is that it should essentially boil down to a misunderstanding, right? Mm-hmm. That neither character should be right or wrong. But here is the Flash telling Bruce to listen to him, and that, like, he's going to get to it in a moment.
So it's Lois Lane.
Where is it? Where is it? It's Lois
Lane.
She's the key. Right. Let's wait for it.
He says he's too soon.
Soon, right.
Grunts in annoyance.
You're right about him. You've always been right about him. Fear him. Maybe he's talking about Luther there, but the heavy implication is that he's talking about Superman. And so when Bruce wakes up, there are papers flying in the background, giving the impression that it's possible that Zack Snyder wanted you to see that previous scene of the Flash cameo as if it was actually happening. If that's the case, and Zack Snyder is imagining a future in which Superman should actually be feared, and all of Batman's fears about Superman are well founded, that misses the entire point of the freaking character of Superman, in my opinion. Like, it is a fundamental issue. If that's the
I feel like. It would that's meant as a red herring, if it's meant as anything at all, because I don't think that they would necessarily go there, especially with what happens with Superman later in this movie. And that's another thing that makes me feel like, okay, well, this is a future that we're not ever going to get to, because everything changed by the end of this movie.
Right. And also, from a logical standpoint, how is Bruce dreaming about characters he's never
precisely
met?
Like, he's like it. That's why this. That's another reason that whole bit is nothing but a convoluted mess that should have been left out of the movie. And we just saw how you could edit that and piece this movie together in a way that just keeps the plot flowing.
I also thought the effects on the Flash suit looked unfinished. I thought the CGI on that
was totally rushed, and they didn't even do a good job of removing Ezra Miller's as yet unshaven mustache. It's totally there.
I like your mustache.
Yeah. He at least looks way better in the Justice League.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, this is another part of the movie, and I swear, people, we're not going to get through the whole thing, but there's a lot to digest here. There really is a lot to talk about in this edition, but this is another thing that we haven't talked about, the great relationship between Bruce and Alfred in this movie.
Right.
Oh, that's very well portrayed.
Jeremy Irons killed it, man. It was always going to be difficult to follow Michael Caine, but now I almost view Michael Caine's Alfred as its own separate thing. Like, it's so distinct and so different, really, from pretty much every incarnation of Alfred that's ever been, that I almost feel like Jeremy Irons is a better interpretation of quote-unquote classic Alfred, whereas Michael Caine Alfred is like a separate Alfred altogether, if that
makes sense. I think I'm always going to prefer the Kane Alfred, but this is a great interpretation, and this is more along the lines of the comic book Alfred. I would agree with that. This is, it's just an incredible performance. He jumps right into the character,
and we jumped off of Affleck a little bit earlier, as we were discussing, our reactions to when he was cast. But I think we should pause here a moment and actually. Call him out for giving a great performance.
Absolutely.
Oh, I fully agree, especially that line that he and Alfred, or that whole exchange that he and Alfred just had, is one of my favorite moments of this movie. He does rattle off the infamous 1% doctrine, but at the same time, he also, you know, asked Alfred after 20 years in Gotham how many good guys are left and how many of them stayed that way. And I was like, that's a great callback to Batman's long history with allies turning on him.
And the sting of DC Comics.
Yeah, it's like his whole deal is, you know, it's kind of that paranoid Batman who's never really worked with, you know, a lot of other heroes, but at the same time he's like, you know, every time I get close to somebody and try to trust someone, they stab me in the back, except for, you know, Alfred.
And that's one thing that Affleck does throughout this movie, in my opinion anyway, is he portrays that world weariness of this version of Bruce Wayne. Every time he's on screen, when you just look in his eyes, even when he's being lighthearted with Alfred, there is this sense of a guy who has seen and been through some shit in his life, and he's about to the end of his rope now. Like, this is a Batman who has lost hope, who is barely making it, basically.
He's almost become exactly the thing that Harvey Dent warned of in The Dark Knight, which is he has lived long enough
to become the villain.
Yeah, he is becoming the villain. He is a villain. If you look at this version of Batman that way, using that philosophy, it actually makes a whole lot of sense. But there's one other scene that they added in just a minute ago that had Clark Kent back in Gotham City. Mm-hmm. Talking to the family of that criminal Batman branded.
Once again, an essential scene.
Absolutely, because the exchange between Clark and this now widow, or I guess he wasn't her husband, but he was the father of her child. And
he was the pappy.
He the pappy. They had her familiar. And he totally gets another parallel moment there where he's being told by this lady that, you know, Batman cannot be reasoned with. He's not somebody who can be talked down. He's somebody that's going to have to be beaten down. That's the only way that he's ever going to stop. And, like, words aren't going to do it. And I'm like, that is another scene that you cut that from the theatrical version, and you've taken away a huge piece that gets paid off in the actual Batman and Superman fight.
Absolutely. We just saw a beautiful homage to the other classic Batman films, with a shot of Batman on that giant crane and that sort of like rotational shot. That's a shot that we saw as far back as Tim Burton's Batman. But then, of course, we saw that shot in each of the Nolan Batman movies. Particularly, I reminded of the shot in Hong Kong in The Dark Knight. Really nice homage there.
And I know that there was. I'm going to say something about this car chase scene, because in a lot of ways, I feel that it's illogical, because we just saw Batman shoot a tracker onto the back of the truck that's hauling away the giant rock of kryptonite.
Mm-hmm.
And if Batman had truly been stealthy about this, he could have just let the tracker do its job and follow never even get into this car chase at all, and thus we would have avoided this whole bit right here that everybody seems to hate so much, which is Batman's about to blow this dude to pieces.
I mean, I got to be honest. I think the scene's a cool action scene, but I'm kind of one of those people who I have a little bit of a problem with it. It doesn't take me out of the scene completely. It doesn't ruin the movie the way some people said, but like, it's one of the few times I can look at Ben Affleck in this movie and go, well, that's not Batman. Like, that's not – to me, that's not what the character
honestly. You
do.
Could also cut this scene a little bit. You could cut out that part where he blows up that car, and the scene still works just fine.
And you know, given what we see later in the movie, the implication is that breaking into LexCorp was like a picnic for him. So why not just wait and pick it up?
Exactly what I was saying. Exactly what I was getting at. Like, this whole chase scene is entirely unnecessary.
Agreed.
And you could have still had him run into Superman, because he could have just let these guys go. Let them haul it on back to LexCorp to
get
it later.
As he's driving away,
yep. He encounters Superman for the first time, and Superman warns him there.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. That was a classic, like, buffoon henchman action movie thing to do. The shot where the
He drives into the gas tanker
and covers his eyes before he does it. That's right out of Commando.
It really was. And the part where the Batmobile breaks through the wall here, and I'm going to say that Bruce didn't intend to kill that dude.
There's the Zack Snyder solution.
But it's gratuitous. Again, it's something that's like Zack is, you know, known for this type of like visual action, which, yes, it looks cool, but it's way overblown. Now, this part I loved. The whole like flares out cool. to take out the missile. Yeah, that was badass.
You know, this scene has some cool things in it. It's just I think the complaint with it is, again, the body count. Yeah,
the body count, the length of it. And like Russell, you put it up.
But this is freaking cool. This was in the trailer, and I loved it. I loved it even more in the movie. Yeah. Even the theatrical.
Does not move.
Cool.
Superman just stands there.
That was
like,
awesome.
I don't have to move. It's like, you are not going to hurt me with your little toy car.
And even the look in Affleck's eyes when that happens, and he's like, oh, it's the oh shit look that he has later in the movie when we're not going to get to that point. But he has the line that absolutely killed it in the theater, the oh shit, which apparently was improv by him for the movie, which is just awesome. During the Doomsday fight, so
yeah.
And in the theatrical cut, this line from Superman about "Don't go to your light in the sky" comes off as the most like
heelish,
condescending, you know, like overly good, punch you in your perfect teeth, to borrow a term from Civil War line there ever was. But in the ultimate cut, you get a reason.
Yeah.
Because him delivering
to
the
Superman,
line.
Batman's a murderer. Batman is essentially a murderer. But you don't get that context in the theatrical version.
This is cool.
This part, like, I would want to keep all of this. I would want to keep at least some of
like
what we
CGI
saw.
CGI on this part right there, though. That was the only part I did.
The CGI wasn't great, but the concept of like, the idea of the totally entrance to the back.
I love that, that door, and cool. I love, like, as it's rolling through here, like, that long driveway. The Batcave is one of the most well-designed. This is probably the best version of the Batcave we've seen in live action.
Definitely.
I would agree.
Aesthetically, it is.
Because even the Nolan one was so overly simplistic.
Yeah,
because really
the Nolan one was literally portrayed as a cave that he just happened to add a few things to. But the Burton one was cool, but not like this.
But here's the thing. Like, he goes immediately back, and what does he do? He picks up his transponder, which is miraculously still attached to this thing after it was nearly taken out by Batman himself. It's like, come on, dude.
Thank God.
Yeah, he's like, that's why he jumped out of the car so fast. He was like, please tell me I didn't just knock my own transponder off of the thing. Please tell me
I just defeat the purpose of my own plan? Oh, God.
So here's the giant Rocko Kryptonite.
And I actually like that they extended this because there's this little look that you're going to see exchanged between Lex and Mercy, which actually plays into something big in Lex's character, because right there he went from smiling to blank and then back to like mild smiling because he knows what he's about to do here. He realizes that Mercy is a connection, and Mercy is potentially a loose end, and he does not leave loose ends. So in every instance, in every part where he gets to tie up a loose end, that was his look saying, I might have like some romantic feeling for her, but that just means that right now she's a liability, and I have to kill her.
Yep. And
good point.
And again, another great scene of Lois being awesome and being the freaking best non-powered female in comics that I know she is, or I feel she is anyway. And I love it. I love all this Lois stuff. It's so good. And I guess at some point we're going to have to bring this thing to an end, so we might as well start wrapping up here.
Well, before we should probably call out a couple of things that we won't reach in the movie. I mean,
sure, absolutely.
That comes to mind, and instantly, to me, the one thing in the theatrical cut that remains in the ultimate cut, it is still like, if you were going to pick out a 5-second moment from this movie, it is Wonder Woman dropping down in front of Batman during the Doomsday fight and saving his ass. Like, it is still the stand up and cheer moment of this movie. Like, it plays even better in the ultimate cut because the movie surrounding it is better. But that's something that that I wanted to shout out, just to make sure we talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
That.
And One thing that I am kind of back and forth on in this Ultimate Edition is the funeral scene, because it already felt a little overly long in the theatrical cut, at least to me. There were parts that like that Zack Snyder slow mo on some things that just felt like it was dragging it out. But there were little bits added into the Ultimate Edition that I really liked, like the table full of casseroles. That might seem like a little thing, but
no, it's a very Midwestern. Yeah. Yep. Like it gives it that feel, and then she actually says the implication all along that I got was that Bruce was bankrolling some of this, but then she actually says she forgot her checkbook.
Yeah, he's.
He mentions that the expenses have all been covered, so that was
yeah, I was cool. Like totally paid for, and I was like, well, I was like, that was nice of you, Bruce, but. Man, you could have sprung for better than a pine box, couldn't you?
Yeah, and that just...
You are a billionaire, true. And you still buried your supposed, like...
Hey, even billionaires have to be efficient with their spending, I guess.
But while you mentioned, you know, you mentioned the funeral scene, that's something we touched on, we mentioned briefly earlier. I guess we should address that. The death of Superman being done in this movie. I gotta be honest, even in the Ultimate Cut... I still don't like it. I still think it's too soon, especially in a movie that, yes, the Ultimate Cut fleshes him out more, but you have not spent enough time with this character to
build that emotional
impact. To really build that emotional impact. Really, honestly, you know, it almost comes off as if Zack Snyder is only killing off Superman so that he can have an excuse to redeem his version of Batman. Like, that essentially, to me, is what the entire point of the Doomsday subset.
Or another possibility is also to give Superman a new persona, a different persona whenever he comes back, which I think it would be kind of wasted if they don't. Because he has to have like a new outlook on life, having just been to the end of it and like coming back from that.
We've not yet seen a Superman who is confident in being Superman.
That's what I'm looking for, is like a Superman who feels confident, and also a Batman who feels confident in being Batman again. Because right now, I don't feel like what we're seeing is a confident Batman. I feel like what we're seeing is a very angry Batman. We're not seeing the caped crusader. We're seeing the darkest of dark knights, and a guy who's like, you know, probably about a step or two shy from being the Punisher. And he's on that bad road. So him turning back, he's rediscovering his humanity. And whenever Clark comes back in Justice League, we need to see, even if it's not until the third act, we still need to see a little bit of that. We need to see a little bit of his like his humanity coming out.
And exactly.
Seeing a version of him that is very poised, very confident. He's like, I know what I'm doing. And even if I'm not necessarily making the exact right call, I'm still going to stand by what I do, and I'm going to actually speak what I feel.
This is a version of Batman that would in this movie that would not have trusted the people at the end of the Dark Knight on the boats to make the right decision.
No,
he would not have. But I agree with Nick on the lack of emotional connection, because this is one element of the movie that still bugs me. I still maintain this, even though I really enjoyed this movie, the extended edition of this movie. I maintain they should have done a Superman sequel before this movie.
I'll agree with that, because I feel like we needed more time with Superman. And if we had a direct Man of Steel sequel with maybe a Batman cameo to set up this movie, the death of Superman would have felt earned. It would have felt like the conclusion of a trilogy. And
yes.
The beginning of a new phase. But here it is, Warner Brothers being in too much of a hurry to get where Marvel is.
That's what I was about to say. If that's one criticism you can throw DC's way that I think sticks so far, it's in a hurry. They are just so...
Very Vince McMahon of you.
Even Suicide Squad, which we haven't seen yet, like, obviously, but like... You get the impression that they're doing it in part because they're in such a hurry to introduce all these different villains and get their universe.
Well, yeah, and
rather than letting it grow.
Right, and again, the death of Superman, that's another debate for another time. For me, it's one of the most emotionally impactful stories of all time in superhero comics, certainly, because I love Superman, because I had years of reading Superman and experiencing Superman and had this connection to Superman, and this generation that basically was introduced to Superman through Man of Steel has not had an opportunity to gain that connection with him and understand how he relates to Perry and Lois and Lois to an extent, but to Perry and to the other characters in his life, to meet other people and to be Superman, to really be Superman. And we haven't had that chance. So for that reason, the death was not impactful for me like it should have been. Because if it had been, I would have been okay with them taking a long time with the funeral scene, because I thought I liked the emotional weight of that. I liked how it was presented. It just did not affect me in the way that it probably should have.
And speaking of Superman saving people, that's something else that we didn't mention about this Capitol scene. We see an extended version of it where Superman was actually pulling people out of the burning building, which was...
Yeah. Because in the theatrical cut, he really comes off like a douche in the scene.
He just
essentially just stands there
and just kind of nods, and which I got because he's showing that he was like, God, I knew that, you know, this is really happening. But again, like you said, it makes him look like an ineffective. That was, again, the theatrical version makes Superman look an ineffective loser. And in this version, you see that he's still a Superman who cares about humanity. He really does want to save people, and didn't get that impression necessarily in the theatrical cut.
And yeah, he saves people in this scene. Like he still looks around and sees all the people that he failed to save, and that's what affects him.
Yep.
But it carries that emotional weight because we witness him witnessing that. So his talk with Lois right after about kicking himself for not seeing the bomb in time carries that much more emotional weight, and of course the reveal of it being
right.
a setup later.
And again, that is necessary to make that line make sense.
Yeah, it all works so much better. And the I felt that the scene of him like walking mountain was more effective too after this because he's the people that try to stop him initially. They have this great line from the old shaman, or the old man, who's like, he didn't come here to cross the mountain; he came here to die, and that kind of resonated with me a little bit, and was a total foreshadowing of what they were going to do to the character later in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right that the death still doesn't have the impact that it should, but I will say that it's there's another horse scene, by the way. It's more impactful in the Ultimate Edition than it was in the theatrical cut. And I still love that last scene with all the people standing in Metropolis holding candles, and like one guy looking like just like several people just looking very emotional, like sobbing even over this, and it looking like very real. But that scene when it pans back and you have the S-Shield gravestone and the writing that says, if you seek his monument, look around you.
Yep.
That right there.
That was like, and it was reminiscent of Funeral for a Friend, which I think both you and I, Russell, agree is one of the most important Superman stories that everyone forgets about.
It absolutely is. Funeral for a Friend and the whole World Without a Superman, which the entire Death and Return of Superman stories have been reprinted recently. So if you're a person who's listening to this and you've never read any of that, highly, highly recommend you go and get that whole collection. It's beautifully done, and they've even added more of the supplemental stuff back into that story. If anything is going like stands a chance of making you a fan of that 90s Superman like me and Greg are, then that story should do it.
Yeah, and what they did through Funeral for a Friend and World Without a Superman that they may very well do in Justice League and take out of that is through, again, it's necessarily a story without Superman in it because he's dead, but it shows the impact he had by showing what happens and how people react to his death. You see how his colleagues in the superhero community react. Most touchingly, you see how Lois and his parents react, but you also see how random people react, that random people are now inspired by his sacrifice to try to do good in the world.
And if there's one thing, if I could have a wish list item for Justice League, it would be for the Flash, actually. For Barry Allen to have actually been influenced by the good that Superman had done in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like for him to be that guy, like when Bruce goes to him and finds him there in his Flash cave or whatever that was that he was in. For him to have some like Superman memorabilia somewhere and to even just flat out say, I got these powers. I didn't know what I was supposed to do with them, but I saw what Superman was doing and what he was trying to do. And I thought, that's the least I could do, is to be that, to use his example. I mean, that would really punch it home for me, for Henry Cavill's Superman, that he had a far-reaching influence beyond what these movies were able to show or what people may have given him credit for. And if you see Flash doing what I really feel like we're seeing him do in these movies, which are just in this little bit we've seen, which is saving people, that's going to be a real testament for Henry Cavill's Superman.
Totally. Well, with all that being said, let's leave people with our final thoughts on this Ultimate Edition. Russell, let's start with you. Final thoughts on this Ultimate Edition before we bring it home.
This is the only edition of this movie that you should ever watch, whether you've seen the theatrical version or not. This is the version of the movie to see. And it's one that I feel like you'll want to watch at least twice just to take it all in. Yes, the problems of the theatrical cut, as far as like the tone and maybe some characterizations, that's still there. That's not going away. But if your problem was the editing and the pacing of this movie in the theatrical version, pretty much all of that is solved in this Ultimate Edition, and it is so much better. And I would like to formally say that the Sellers Points review of Batman v Superman, the Ultimate Edition, goes to a 4-star out of 5 film. It's back. There it is. The theatrical cut still sitting at a 2.5. That's how much difference 30 minutes can make.
Excellent. We got a little bit exclusive here on the show. See, not only are we the home of the Ho-Ho Loon Cruiserweight Classic Update ticker, but we're also the home of exclusive revelations about new reviews for movies. So hopefully that will set the stage for things to come. Nick, final thought on this Ultimate Edition of BVS.
Fuck whoever edited the theatrical cut.
How do they relate Never. To the B. Brian Blair?
Whoever edited this isn't as good as the B. Brian Blair, because they wouldn't be allowed to suck. never mind. We're not going to get into that.
Breaking it out. We've gone R-rated.
No, seriously. Like, the idea that this is what it should have been and that the theatrical cut was ever released, that somebody approved that, is just frustrating. Which is not to say that the theatrical cut is terrible, but my opinion of it is certainly less than now, and I honestly can't believe some of the decisions that were made. It's bewildering what happened here. All that being said, Ultimate Cut, very, very good movie. I don't know. I don't know what my scale would be, but I'd say, 7.5 or 8 out of 10, I guess, somewhere around the same thing that Russell's saying. Maybe just a touch less, but that's only maybe.
I agree with you guys. This makes a huge difference. Everybody that has heard me talk about Batman vs. Superman knows that I was a lot lower on it even than you guys were coming out of it. Like I just thought it was a very mediocre movie, and the more I've thought about it, the more problems I've found with it. This changes a lot of that. Some things are never going to work for me. The portrayal of Lex in this movie is never going to work for me. And if that's a deal breaker for you, then maybe don't watch this. But I'm telling you, as far as a pure plot goes, I think this is one of the better plots we've seen in a superhero movie, having seen the extended edition. I think it's where it might misstep a few times on characterizations. The plot and the pacing are actually a lot better than a lot of other superhero movies out there. I think it's really clever. I think the scheme from Luthor is really clever. I think there are certain things that still bug me. The Martha scene, Lex, But within the greater context of the movie, this is a really good movie, folks, in my opinion. The structure is so much better in this Ultimate Edition. I would suggest give this a watch, and at the very least, I don't think you'll hate it, even if you hate some of the characterizations. And if the characterizations, for the most part, you were okay with, I think you'll love this one, because I ended up loving this one on the Ultimate Edition. So I still don't know if it's as good as Man of Steel for me, but it's pretty damn good. So unanimously from all three of us, give the Ultimate Edition of Batman vs. Superman a try and burn the theatrical cut. So
just take that whenever you buy the Blu-ray, just take that disc and the DVD and just toss them in the trash.
Trash. Do what I once did to the Michael Bay movie The Island and burn it. And there's a throwback to my Troy University peeps. Anyway, that brings to an end. We said we weren't going to go 3 hours, but we had a pretty long one here, folks. But there's a lot to unpack with this movie. We hope you enjoyed the ride. We hope you got a little bit of information, a little bit of entertainment, and enjoyed the movie as well with us. And be sure to join us next week. We're going to come back with another Hard Traveling Families. What's on deck, Nick?
We've actually got a special edition planned that's going to feature a full-length Suicide Squad review. And I can't make any promises at this point, but the plan is for Greg and I to bring in the equivalent of the Smith Hart, Bruce Hart, and Keith Hart to our Brett and Owen to fill out our Survivor Series team. We're going to bring in all the bench players, all the no-names.
We are calling it NWO
to fill out
team.
A panel. That's right. We are calling in.
You're gonna have Nash and Hall and Waltman or Nash and Hall and Hogan with me and Russell and Nick, and then you're gonna have the Vincent and the Brian Adams and the and who else was in the B team, for God's sake?
Scott Flash Norton.
Wasn't Horace in the B team? I don't know. I think so.
Who knows this?
We're throwing a Dennis Rodman in there somewhere.
Anyway,
Dennis Rodman.
The idea is that we're bringing in some of our personal friends who have never made an appearance on the podcast before, if this works anyway, technically, for a roundtable discussion of Suicide Squad after we all see it together next weekend. So that's the plan for next week. And then in the coming weeks, I believe we've got a Long Book Hunters on Kieran Gillen's The Wicked and the Divine coming up. And also, then we get into, you know, another countdown at some point. And as well, I think in September, we're going to have our first edition of Hard Travelers for Hire, which will begin that series with, of course, 2008's Iron Man. So lots of things coming down the pipe.
Russell, I believe you've got a big announcement about your podcast, Sellers Points. Tell us what's coming down the line here pretty soon on Sellers Points.
Oh, I'm going to be making a big announcement on the next edition of the podcast, which I'll actually be recording within a week or so. I'm going to have a very special guest. A very good friend of mine is going to be joining me on that one. And Greg, I want you to pay very special attention to that podcast, because I'll go ahead and tell you guys what the theme of the podcast will be: Legion of Superheroes. And if you're not familiar with the concept, you should very well be after my guest, who I'll go ahead and announce it here, a Hard Traveling Fanboys exclusive, Mr. Kelly Poole, the former owner of Empire Comics in Enterprise, Alabama, will be joining me as my guest and co-host on the show.
A guest and co-host with very strong ties to the Hard Traveling Fanboys as well.
Absolutely. He is very strong ties to both of you guys. He is he's going to be coming on. We're going to be talking about our favorite Rebirth comics, what he's been reading. We're going to give you some background on him, and then we're going to get into it deep on the we're going to go deep on Legion of Superheroes. So, you know, guys, be looking forward to that one. And that's going to be my next edition of Sellers Points.
And again, thank you, Russell, for joining us. First time you've been on, won't be the last. And thank you guys out there for listening to the off-the-page edition on Batman vs. Superman, Ultimate Edition. Hope you tune in next time. And in the meantime, remember, if you want to send PayPal payments to us to to put money on Ho-Ho Loon to win the Cruiserweight Classic, just contact us through the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, and we'll hook you up.
And one last thing, I am totally on that bandwagon now. Ho-Ho Loon will make an appearance on Sellers Boys.
Ho-Ho Lunamania is running, running sexy, wild, brother.
Easy as
take care, everyone.
Just let your soul go. Just let it shine through. Just let your soul go, baby. Feel it.